das Buch.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Das
it read,
Buch.
When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Das
in the public mind, label them
das
fact. Label them fascist fact. Label them Nazi fact. Label them anti-Semitic fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact. Fact.
Fact. Yes. Das Buch.
Wake up.
I don't want to wake up.
The following program deals with controversial subjects. The theories expressed are not the only possible interpretation. The viewer is invited to make a judgment based on all available information.
Let's go.
I could.
Only a dream.
I
think,
therefore I am.
Das Buch.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Das Buch.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am. Let there be light.
Yes,
Dos.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Dos.
It read, when certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Das Buch.
In the public mind, label them
Das Buch.
Fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact. Fact.
Fact. Yes.
Luke Notaras. Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras.
Notaras. N-O-T-A-R-A-S.
Das Buch.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Das
it read,
Buch.
When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Das Buch.
In the public mind, label them
Das Buch.
Fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact. Fact.
Fact. Yes. Das Buch.
Wake up.
I don't want to wake up.
The following program deals with controversial subjects. The theories expressed are not the only possible interpretation. The viewer is invited to make a judgment based on all available information.
Let's go.
I
could.
Only a dream.
I think, therefore I am.
Das Buch.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Das Buch.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Das Buch.
Let there be light.
Yes,
Dos. Notaras.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Dos.
It read,
Buch.
When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Das Buch.
In the public mind, label them
Das Buch.
Fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact.
Fact. Luke Notaras.
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 Notaras. Notaras.
Das Buch.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Das
it read, Buch. When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
Das Buch.
In the public mind, label them
Das Buch.
Fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact.
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 Yes.
All right.
Wake up!
I don't want to wake up.
The following program deals with controversial subjects.
Ah, yes.
The theories expressed are not the
only. Let's turn the repeat off.
The viewer is invited to make a judgment based on.
All right, we've turned that off. All right, it would appear we're live now. Excellent, excellent. We should have Luke with us as well.
Yep, I'm here.
There you go. Yeah, where are you at? LOL. Yeah, I was getting shit done. Yeah, I went right to like 7:56 with the pre-meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the RTMP codes weren't cooperating. But we've got it done now. We've got it done now. Confirming. Yes, see, we're live on FTJ. That's good. And look at that. We're live on Odyssey. That's good. And our backup. Let's see. Rumble. Yep. It's working over. Right. It's excellent. All right. So now Rumble's a pain in the ass to download, but at least there's always an archive of what's streamed over there. So that's an upside. And Entropy. Yep. Okay. We're live there as well. All right. Everything is up and running. Now, you have Lucas provided once again, not that I assign homework assignments, but he's just that organized. He gives these updated Haas notes, and the Haas is the author of The Destiny of the Mind, East and West. So we have those on hand. We have some other materials that have been sent. So by way of preface, is there anything you'd like to add about today's show or what we've read in Chapter 8?
Yeah, this chapter, Chapter 9, it's called Concentration. And there is a little bit of overlap with previous chapters in Haas's book so far, specifically Chapter 2, Chapter 3, State and Society 1, and then also the most previous one, Chapter 8. So this is like a direct pickup of East-West distinctions in knowledge, philosophic thought versus Fallujah. It all ties in. So.
Ah, yes. All right, remind us again, Fallujah is not so much the opposite of, but the Eastern equivalent of what?
Yeah, philosophy. So in the West, the way the mind structure works is philosophy, which would be philo sophia, the love of knowledge or the love of wisdom. And philousia, which is a neologism that Haas coined for the East, would be philo, loving. And ousia, which would be Greek for essence. So in the East, they have a love of essence, staying connected to everything else around them, the real, capital R, the absolute, whatever you want to call it. They haven't made that subject-object distinction like the West. Everything they perceive would be varying degrees of distance, as if they're still tethered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a very... Yes, an important distinction, and Haas, we think this is unique in all of consideration of the Eastern and Western mind. Not that no one's done that before, but it's the way that Haas approaches it, such that he wanted to provide for people of a Western mind a better understanding of the Eastern mind. So to do that, sometimes you have to create equivalencies that people can identify with. And instead of saying they have no mechanism of self-reflection or the investigation of knowledge or even how you know things, instead of just assuming that, he said, no, they have an approach. It's just so different. We have to name it something different. And so that's what Fallujah is.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is really cool, like you said, that it is unique to Haas. So with all the things that he read, everything that he amalgamated with a Western mind, his own, he still took into consideration things like Hindu traditions and their old school Sanskrit texts. He did a lot of research on the East, the soul of the Orient. So, the biggest point that we keep hammering on is Haas is trying to make the distinction between peoples. In this case, he's saying East and West, but it's applicable to so much more. So it's just trying to get people to realize not everybody is the same. And I think, unfortunately, that's way too broad of an assumption that everybody goes along with.
Yeah. Yes. So an earlier adopter of, it's more than HBT or IQ nationalism, right? It's, he has his reasons, but suffice it to say he's on team inequality. Yeah. He's on team. Yeah. There are extreme differences in not just the races, but even of people separated by geography, which just happens to overlap in many ways with different races.
Yes. And so, I like that he hasn't explicitly stated that there is an incompatibility with people of these differing mind structures, but he does seem to imply that there is an incompatibility with the way the minds work.
Yes.
So yeah, we can always understand conceptually in the West, how the Oriental man operates on that level.
Let's put it this way. He's making a great argument for why people are culturally, racially, and in fact, cognitively incompatible. So anyway, yeah, even if he doesn't have to say it, I'm fine if he never says it in the book, because frankly, he is, he's laying out the argument for it and importing into that argument a lot of evidence to support that argument.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so valuable for us to really dig into and put in context as whites, you know, white nationalists, people who are in full support of white activism, white advancement of our interests. This is really beneficial for us to know.
Oh, yeah, and not just that. If he were a contemporary guy, we'd have reason enough to read him. But frankly, he is a gifted thinker from another time. And I think the more of this we do, the better. Because I think anyone reading Haas and Haas's contemporaries would find themselves impressed by the type of thinking and the written expression people engaged in then. And frankly, it reminds me when Haas is writing about things, well, I'm reminded of two things. One, gee, it's rare that anyone spends this much time laying out their argument, scaffolding, approaching the evidence in a way that is complex, but always interconnected, and constantly doing callbacks to remind you, like, oh yeah, remember, this is where we are in the comparison of the East and West mind. So that's essential. And then also, frankly, he writes beautifully, and it can be dense, sometimes convoluted. But if you reread it, I've had to reread some of Haas twice, and once you reread it, though, you say, oh, it's just that people don't talk like that anymore. They don't write like that anymore. This is why I may be having trouble with it. And so there's a certain intrinsic beauty to his writing, I'm going to say. I think that's two good reasons to be looking at someone like Haas and some of his contemporaries. There's no reason we wouldn't be pulling in some of his contemporaries like Revelo P. Oliver, perhaps even tonight. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. And definitely, like you said, that specific prose that's kind of seems atavistic now. But it is there's a stark contrast and there's a beauty to it that's hard to ignore. Like, you got to appreciate it. And some of the words that he uses are words that he coined himself. And even though he's an academician, he doesn't really like to do any kind of like comedic poking at things. But in this chapter later on, he actually does, which is quite surprising and really fun. So that'll be cool to go over.
And just a final note on this, because, because we're keeping it real. reading guys like Haas and some of his brilliant contemporaries, you can't help but think, you know, if we all stayed as smart as Haas and Revelo P. Oliver were, as studious, as industrious, and frankly, as fucking prolific some of these guys were, if we maintained that level of intelligent advocacy for our race, I can't help but think how far along we'd be compared to now. And that's not to say anyone's dumb now. I'm just saying that we have been degraded. Okay. You can't deny that the state of American education is retarded, not in the pejorative sense. And I mean, everyone's wearing helmets and drooling. I mean, it's been retarded. It's been taken a step down, well, many steps down. And that isn't the fault of anyone who's like suffered under this education system. It's just that we've got more work to do. You know what I mean? That's why we're doing what we're doing, because there's more work to do. There's a whole world of beautiful expression of the same ideas that are written in memes, but they're really fleshed out in a way that an argument can become undeniable as to the conclusion. And so it's important. Not that you always have to read that kind of thing, but I think people not just deserve, but I think we require, it's required that we expose ourselves to stuff like this.
Yeah, just raise the bar a little bit.
Yep, nothing wrong with that. Everyone can hack it. I think we can all hack it. All right, yeah, well, we're going to
everybody here at least.
Well, yeah, everyone, if you're here, right, self-selecting. If you're here, you're like ready. You're ready to do the chin up on the new height bar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. All right. So chapter 9, concentration. And Luke will do us the favor of a bit of recapitulation of chapter 8, because it's been a week and let's face it, all these chapters, they have a lot to them. So go ahead, recapitulate for us, Luke.
Yeah. Well, before we do that, and I guess this is kind of a bit of a recap as well. I did reread Revelo Oliver's book, The Jewish Strategy, this week.
Ah, nice.
Mm. And I found some potentially connecting material. I remember Revelo was the guy who shouted out Haas, apparently not in this book, though. So it must have been one of the other two that I read, either Enemy of Our Enemies, Enemy of Europe, that he did after Yaki's death, or The Education of a Conservative, America's Decline. But in this Jewish strategy book, in the end, when Revelo is talking about early Christianity and this kind of split from Gnosticism, he mentioned a person named Tertullian. Mm. And I did a little bit of digging into this because Tertullian talked about the Trinity, the Christian Trinity, which we've discussed in the context of Haas early on and then in the last chapter as well. So. Mm. This Tertullian character, Quintus Septimus Florens Tertullianus, circa 155 to 250 AD, was a prolific early Christian author from the then Roman province of Carthage, which would be like modern day Tunisia in Africa. Some say he was Berber. We was polemicists and shit, but it was more likely that he was Punic. Levantine or Semitic, but not Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And Tertullian was actually critical of Jews. So he dedicated several writings to expose their pernicious involvement in Roman society and the church, which Kikes still say are anti-Semitic today. but Tertullian was the first Christian author to produce Christian literature in Latin. And his main work was the Apologeticus, which attacked the heresy of Gnosticism. And he introduced these new concepts, advanced the development of a subordination theory within the Trinitas, the Trinity. So basically this ontological subordination of varying degrees, the Son and the Holy Spirit were considered submissive in their role to the Father.
Ah.
And there was an offshoot of this called Arianism, which is A-R-I-A, not A-R-Y, but from the founder Arius. And Arianism developed out of Tertullian's theory like 50 years later, considering Jesus to be a creation of God, distinct from God. So as a begotten Son of God, separate, Jesus could not be considered co-eternal with God. And I feel like that's huge because it ties in with Haas's subject-object distinction.
Yes. And,
Yeah, this Arianism or Arianism is considered heretical now since the Second Council of Constantinople in 553 AD. And that was, of course, when these three chapters of the Bible were anathematized, excommunicated, thrown out. But Tertullian's view was more in line with understanding the Trinity to be three personifications of a potentially connected but hierarchical broader entity like the Hindu Trimurti. And Arianism took the hierarchical idea but separated the components to distinct entities, which engendered new questions about the context of accompanying teachings. Mm. And in modern Christianity, and most specifically Eastern Orthodoxy, that evinces the need for reversion to a more subjective view, even though considerations of object distinction among the entities, because now they're just all called God, that was already explored 250 years before. So even though mainstream Christianity regards subordination theory and Arianism heretical, people still argue certain verses and passages in the New Testament where Jesus mentions things like, I and the Father are one, or my Father is greater than I. These conceptual interpretations must be toiled over and clarified through philosophy in the Western mind. But both of those notions are perfectly reconcilable and non-contradictory to the Eastern mind. So I feel like that all ties in with Haas and what we've been doing these last few weeks.
Yeah, it does. Hmm. Well, that is fascinating. So did you see the triad graphic I put up? So that does apply to an earlier discussion. So it's like wheels within wheels, these arrays. Yep. All interconnected. Yeah. Now I've got to say, I think the work he shouted out, Hostin, must be the enemy of my enemies thing, because I didn't even read the other one. And I do recall the Haas shout out. So we've narrowed it down where it must be that. Must be the Yaki response, the post Yaki death response. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that book. It's a little bit shorter, but it's like a exegesis of basically recapitulating, but also. Yeah, correcting a lot of the things that Francis Barker Yaki said. So, as always, Oliver killed it.
Yeah, Bravo Lopi Oliver.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Another guy we can learn a lot from. So this is another reason why you should be doing this. Is follow along, relate to the work in the ways you see fit. Either way, we're certain that you're going to learn something.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and as always, it's all about context. So a lot of these things that Haas is talking about, they can be applicable to your own personal subjective experiences. And that's how this all can be made use of.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, there's plenty to learn. So there's no shortage of that. It's really just a matter of... be either what to do with it or how to assemble it onto a larger framework. And that's why, if you're here already, you probably, like ourselves, you believe that the best framework of understanding to graft all of this onto all this new information onto is in fact the only eternal battle of any consequence. And sure, you can call it good versus evil, but we tend to say it's the Aryan versus the Jew. And so what we are understanding here may not be explicitly counter-Semitic, but we're understanding an Eastern versus Western mind. We had seen what Haas had to say about those of a hybrid East and West mind, and it reflected very much what we see in Jews. And so, yeah, the opportunity to graft new understandings onto this framework we have, which, again, we think is the superior way of analyzing the world. So we continue to do so. All right, Luke, is it time for that that recapitulation of the pure subject, the pure consciousness, and this dismantling process?
Yeah, yep. Haas picks up right where he left off in Chapter 8, in the beginning of Chapter 9, Concentration. So Haas gives these descriptions of the Eastern mind striving for the discovery of pure subject through their process of dismantling, and he sheds more light on that supreme goal. So pure subject is the equivalent of pure consciousness to the Eastern mind, which is what remains after all physical and psychological phenomena have undergone the dismantling process. So that was ascending these levels of consciousness by shedding or divesting the superfluous magnitudes of otherness in order to increase the proportion of self, basically like a transformation. And that's the easiest, quickest way to pretty much sum up everything we discussed in Chapter 8 with regard to the East, that dismantling. So whereas the West would have to break apart the objects around them after they've observed them and then use the subsequent constituent parts to build new things constructively, the Eastern mind just sheds or divests everything they don't need so that they can increase the proportion of themselves. And that would be this pure subject, pure consciousness that Haas is saying is their supreme goal.
Yes, which again, I'll mention, while, you know, it seems, I mean, this is from the perspective of a Western mind again, but boy, that sounds sounds like a liberating approach. But then again, the Western mind can't help but desire to again do that whole break apart and reconstruct, reconfigure parts of understanding. It's sort of what we do. But doesn't it sound liberating that you would just shed off unnecessary? Just shed off completely unnecessary notions and ideas, and some of them could be infectious ideas that are counterproductive and things like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It pretty much destroys the idea of always looking for the next best thing, because you have something that you can consider good enough, and then you can just focus on cultivating that instead of constantly wondering, can I do better?
Mm-hmm. Which again it's the very thing that defines us, but at the same time, in that sense, it does seem silly to say you'd be liberated by losing it. But then again, it is such a burden, the white man's burden, the way the Western mind devises civilization, the process of it, it is, simultaneously painful and glorious. We do need to return to it though. Of course, we've been losing the capacity to develop and maintain a civilization for some time now. We've been under such attack, again, in that grand overarching war between the Jew and the Aryan. We've been under attack so long, and we've been losing for so long, that maybe it's more important than ever to have a good understanding of the Eastern and Western mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Haas said, actually, I think, did you have something to say about the levels of consciousness? No, you've already mentioned that. So I'll just tell you what Haas mentioned, and then we'll get your thoughts on this, Luke. Haas said the possibility of attaining the Eastern goal and the comprehension of its significance do not baffle the imagination, as does the goal of the West. The significant question is this. In this dismantling process, what becomes of the other?
Yes. Yeah. And Haas saying that, you know, baffled the imagination. This Western imagination being baffled pertains to the mind faces itself, or thought becomes its own object, like Eddington's ultimate formula and Parmenides. Mm. Our mind's apotheosis exists in concept as a transformation that invalidates everything that got us there, when there's no more subject to make the distinction which drives our consciousness. So I think that's why he's saying it's easier for the East, because they don't have to do this complete transformation of their mind structure from subject to object. We have to do that. So it's a totally different thing, and it's way easier for them to do, which he elucidates further on in much clearer detail.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, excellent. So yes, you're going to now advance to the discussion of the Eastern subject or self, and that'll transition into, yeah, what is essentially the brand new material in Chapter 9.
Yes. Yeah, basically, as the Eastern subject, or the self, advances to pure consciousness, the other, which would be everything else around them, changes, losing both reality and meaning, existing and defined by its proximity to and dependence on the subject. The other is either reduced to insignificance or dissolved when pure consciousness is achieved. And that would be the answer to Haas's question, the significant question in this dismantling process: what becomes of the other? It basically disappears into insignificance, dissolved.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just sort of like the informational background radiation noise of the universe. So yeah. Yeah, it's he has a certain beauty in that explanation. And yeah. So you had mentioned here a very important reminder and distinction from Haas. Let's get into that.
Yeah, so asking whether the pure consciousness can still be called the subject upon elimination of the other is devoid of sense, according to Haas. In contradistinction to the West, where the mind facing itself means a transformation from the subject into an object, something Haas describes as subject-object antagonism that is fatally entwined, the Eastern subject assiduously maintains its sovereignty with regard to the other. It retains the freedom to deal with itself and undergo transmutation. So, although this is seemingly remote from the Western experience at first glance, the Eastern realization of pure consciousness and persistently accompanying self-consciousness, Haas explains that fairly analogous states can and have been illustrated in Western literature, but only expressed as preliminary states, with the acknowledgement that a perfect realization still eludes.
Mm. Haas says, as a guide, the psychology of concentration will serve us well.
Yeah, so that's like the crux of this chapter. That's what he really wants to hammer home now.
So he's now going to venture to explain concentration further in context.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And before I took note of the initial distinctions he makes between Western and Eastern concentration, I did this preliminary etymology research. So the word concentration comes from the Latin concentrum, meaning to bring or come to a common center, where con would mean with, and centrum or centrum equals center. So concentration can be defined as the action of bringing to a center, collecting or combining about a central point. And interestingly enough, it wasn't until phrenology in 1825 that concentration was used to define voluntary continuous focusing of mental activity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the phrenology, that was like the skull shapes and sizes developed by German physician and anthropologist Franz Josef Gall. And this was understood by his contemporaries as legitimate until the kike Franz Boas, another anthropologist, contributed these quote unquote landmark studies to debunk it. Yeah. And I actually did the etymology of debunk because when I said that, I said, what does that mean? So debunk would actually be D meaning out or down, and bunk is nonsense. So debunk means putting down or relegating to nonsense. And in modern academic circles, phrenology is now called a pseudoscience, even though it was universally agreed upon as legitimate back then.
Yes, well, they also write, they also no longer render homosexuality to be a mental disorder. So, yeah, things change. Things change. It doesn't make anything more or less true. Things just change. Yes. Well, that is fascinating because, sure, the term concentration intuitively has always meant this idea of action of bringing to a center or a central point, collecting or combining around a central point as you can almost picture something like coalescing. And this makes sense why, literally, not a joke, why these detention facilities in World War II would be called concentration camps. Like, this makes a lot of sense. But I had no idea that this this attribution of a continuous focused mental activity was something that didn't even come about until the creation of phrenology. It was sort of an afterthought of phrenology. It's very interesting. So it must mean that much as Haas looks at the geographic terrain and the limitations that provides, and then comes up with a theory of the mind that emerges out of the differences in the people, you know, again, by way of the geography and its separation from others. It's as if phrenology was kind of looking at the topographic map of the mind and saying, ah, yes, deep in there, that's where the concentration can occur.
Yeah, I like that take. I hadn't thought of it like that. That's cool. But it does seem legitimate, like there is overlap.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me want to study phrenology more.
Yeah. I do have a phrenology book, but it's one of, you know, it's a newer book, so it just, of course, dismisses all of it. But you can still find in there some references to phrenology and like, oh, isn't this or that silly? And yet they just made a point where you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. It does seem, Right. In other words, cranial capacity and intelligence and things like this. Oh, yeah, actually, there is a connection. But it being a modern book, the final conclusion is, but isn't that silly to attribute the potential of a person to their, you know, it's very reductionist or whatever. That's their argument. It's like, well, some things are reductive, actually. Some things are explained in very simple ways because the connection is A to B. You don't need a lot of a lot of detail between A and B. But anyway, yes. So help us understand the normal process of concentration and where Haas takes this.
Yeah, well, Haas starts with the West and describing the normal process of concentration. Haas mentions the intention of focusing attention to an object to penetrate deeper into it and acquire more knowledge about it. And naturally, due to this interest and the intended purpose, attentive concentration is bound to the object.
And Haas says, whether this contradiction be scrutinizing and thoughtful, or the contemplative and aesthetic, the subject-object relation remains unimpaired, even when the subject forgets about himself throughout the process. Indeed, if the subject remain conscious of himself, the opposition of the subject and the object, which is the condition of the act of concentration, would not be possible.
Exactly. So that goes along with what he said before about the Western need to self-abnegate when focusing on or observing objects in isolation. That's part of our process of philosophy. We have to reduce our focus on ourselves so that we can shift focus on whatever it is we're observing.
Yeah, it's often even described as like, well, to consider this problem, you'll have to step outside of yourself. Like, that's only a Western-minded thing could even say such a thing. could even conceive of such a thing. Yeah, well, but it makes sense.
Brings that up.
Oh, good.
Later on, he uses the word when he talks about this concept of rapture and the etymological root being in ecstasis or ecstasy would literally mean stepping out of oneself. So that's exactly like you just said.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell us more then about this quote we've just read, this business of emptying one's mind entirely in order to occupy it only with a thought.
Yeah. Yeah, Haas says emptying the mind entirely in order to occupy it only with the object in thought or contemplation is a particularly difficult art. And he says, if it be not bestowed as a gift of nature. So he's basically saying it's just a matter of luck if you can do this or not. But the better the concentration, the more the object contemplated appears as what it is, proportional with the clarity of thinking in the subject. So no matter the form or magnitude of concentration, the subject-object relation thus remains undisturbed. And this all reminded me of these aphantasia memes that have been spreading around the last 10 years or so, where they discuss the varying degrees of ability or a complete inability to mentally visualize something on demand. And just for context and potential accompanying discussion, I saved a few of those memes and sent them to you for presentation. Do you have them on hand?
Yes, I do. You want the first one, Apple meme?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here goes.
Yeah, so this kind of goes along with what Haas is saying, where he's saying the better the concentration, the more the object contemplated appears as what it is, proportional with the clarity of thinking in the subject. And there's always a subject-object relation that remains undisturbed because we understand ourselves, even if we try to take ourselves out of the picture. Even in this meme, it's like you see a literal outline of the person's head, which would be the subject trying to think of this object, which in the case is an apple. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just felt like there was a little bit of overlap because this is the first thing I thought of when I read this portion of Haas's chapter.
And these memes are born out of what type of a political discussion or a discussion about IQ, or what's the idea here?
I don't know. From what I could tell, it was like about 2015 when somebody brought this up as just like a Twitter post, and they were jokingly saying, you know, what can you see when you close your eyes, when you try to visualize an apple in your mind? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, including myself, I close my eyes. I don't see anything. I am a number 5 on this thing. I see nothing. So it almost sounds like a troll. When I ask people, what do they visualize? But when I asked you, Davis, you said, oh yeah, I can see this apple clear as day. I can manipulate it, move it around, flip it up and down. I can describe what the color is, you know, the sheen, the light reflecting off of it. And that baffles me. So it is very interesting to see the difference in people's ability to do this.
Well, I have been thinking about you saying that. And I'm trying to better understand. So I'll ask you a clarifying question. As someone who clearly, you know what an apple is, you've eaten an apple. And it's not like you struggle with the concept of apple or even the features of an apple such that you describe it as, you know, red, glossy, whatever. So then if someone were to ask you, Luke, paper, pencil, draw an apple. Are you suggesting you're unable to draw an apple because you can't see anything in your mind's eye when someone says picture an apple? Or are you simply suggesting that you conceptually convey the platonic apple in a different way than other people?
Not at all. I could draw an apple. I could give you a detailed description of an apple with vivid prose. I could use any number of descriptive words to tell you exactly what it is, what it should look like.
How do you draw an apple if you can't picture an apple?
Well, that's just it. It's hard to explain. When I close my eyes, I just see black. but I can still describe the characteristics of the apple. I know what it's supposed to look like. I just don't see anything.
Okay.
So I can still transfer my thoughts to concrete reality or some fantastical drawing of it. I just don't see it when I close my eyes.
Okay. So you just don't have a symbolic or semiotic approach to the way you organize your knowledge. And that is just how different minds work differently. Yep. 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 So you're not at all dyslexic, right? I'm going to guess.
No, not even remotely. And I don't have any other, like neuroatypical eccentricities like synesthesia or anything. I just can't see anything when I close my eyes. But I can come up with what it should be, and I can translate my thoughts to drawings or writings or descriptive terminology. Mm. It's just not a vivid, colorful, concrete image in my eyes. I just see the back of my eyelids.
Oh, yeah, I get it. Well, again, you're not defective. A lot of people work this way, and others just work differently. Just means that, by the way, so that's called spatial reasoning, the spatial ability to picture something and rotate it on an axis or whatever. So you'd be terribly suited to be an engineer, for example. But that means you have other strengths because you're not encumbered by being limited to semiotics and symbols, because that is, in a way, a limitation. It's a completely different faculty, in other words.
Well, I sent another meme that I imagined was the first thing that you think of. So do you want to show everybody what that is?
Oh, well, first I haven't shown Apple II.
Oh, yeah. That's just a variation of this one. Same thing.
Oh, good. Let's do that.
A little bit different quality.
Yeah, that's a little different quality. You're right. Okay, yeah. We'll go to the third one now. Now, wait a second.
Yeah, that's the Davis Apple.
Yeah, breaking my balls as usual. This is the ScarJo, the ScarJo apple.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
And I did have another video that I'll share a screen and cue it up in a second.
Sure.
Because it's just a kind of a funny variation of this meme, which I imagine some of the people in the chat might actually think like this. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Just got to navigate. And it doesn't have any audio. It's just video.
That's fine. Ah, adding to stage now.
So this is the, what some people might see.
Wow.
That's right. All sorts of shit going on.
Everything's going on. See, this person needs some Eastern tradition to shed away the nonsense going on in the mind and focus on the apple.
Yeah, time to go through the dismantling process.
Yeah, look at that. Yeah, you need some serious dismantling and shedding, because you've got the non-Platonic Negro. You've got the apple cat. Yeah, look at, there's a lot going on. You've got the penis exploding chamber. There's a lot happening. And you're not going to be able to focus on the apple at all.
That's right. And I think what's weird about Haas's description of concentration here, he's basically saying there is this proportion. So your ability to concentrate and the resulting vivid imagery, it goes hand in hand. It's correlative. But it seems like to the East, concentration would be almost the opposite. It's like getting rid of everything else around you so that you can reach this pure subject, pure self, pure consciousness state. Totally the opposite.
Yes. Yes. Another one of these examples where the East and West are not so much, well, they're often complementary, but it's just as often oppositional in the way they approach information and classifying that information, consuming that information, and synthesizing that information.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, and on one hand, it could be something that, like, for the West, you have to put a lot of effort in, but to the East, this is autonomic. So
yes,
Haas will describe how.
So to, just to equate it for people, so it's like blinking your eyes. You don't have to think about it. It's autonomic.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like breathing. It's just a natural function that's always on.
So that's why the West needs a word like concentration, because mm-hmm. we so often have to intentionally engage in the act of, the act of concentrating. I'm repeating myself, but yeah, just so the business of, completely surrendering the bulk of the resources for thinking to a single problem or a single act or a single issue.
Yeah.
Which, as you can see, would be a great advantage civilizationally, but at the same time is a bit of a burden when you've got other people walking around with this autonomic sorting happening, where they just shed away nonsense information, where we have to parse it, assign it in a hierarchy of importance, see if it integrates and plugs in with other parts of information. And yeah, it's just an ever-loving pain in the ass, but the output is, no one can deny it, Western civilization has many glories.
Well, yeah, and like you said, it's a burden, but it's also an attack vector for kikes to exploit, because they can just flood your eyes and your thoughts with a never-ending stream of completely inane, useless, superfluous garbage.
Oh, they wouldn't do that. That would lower the quality of our people and civilization.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I dare say that these memes that we just shared could be an instance of that, where it's divisive, it gets people to shit fling and say, you're retarded NPC nigger if you don't see anything when you close your eyes, completely ignoring everything else that might characterize a person, their intellect, their contributions, their abilities. You can just kind of shoehorn it into this fake, shit flinging back and forth.
Yeah, it becomes like an if-then thing instead of, right. Well, there's actually many different ways of conceptualizing and synthesizing information, instead of that being the thought, which this is why it works so well, by the way, because when something is very if-then, it's very black-white, it's very Manichaean, then that's easy for the Jews to control, because then there's only two sides, and you can amplify one side or the other on the vector of attack, and people inevitably bite. I mean, after all, it is social media. What is social media good for, except for demonizing something and lionizing something else, sometimes with very little reason?
Yeah. Yep.
And well, that was quite brilliant. So he's just taken some time to describe the normal process of concentration for the West. So now he's going to help us consider the East.
Yeah. So considering the East to excel in the refined enjoyment of the sensual, as well as the higher goods of life, Haas seeks to describe their devoted ingenuity in creating techniques designed for that purpose. Subtly and radically, concentration is employed to sever the ties binding man and his earthly existence. And the question, of course, which first impresses the mind is concentration on what? But Haas says this question doesn't carry the importance which might be expected. So whether attempting to...
That seems important. Mm-hmm. Help us understand that. So subtly and radically, concentration is employed to sever the ties binding man and his earthly existence. This is now, Haas is explaining how the Eastern mind would critically see the way the Western mind works, or am I misunderstanding this?
No, I think he's making the distinction between the lowercase r real and the capital R real, which he's employed in the last couple of chapters.
Okay, actually, that makes a lot more sense. Okay.
He's saying for the East to concentrate, they have to ignore the concrete reality around them.
Yes, okay.
Could be an approximation in our mind of severing the ties, but they're not actually, because they're still connected through that affinity and correspondence and subjectivity view.
Understood.
So Haas is saying it's likely that we're thinking, well, what are they concentrating on? If that's the case, if they're trying to ignore everything around them, what are they concentrating on? And that's what Haas is saying is not, it's not as important as you might think initially. So he tries to describe that further.
Right. So in other words, the answer also may be concentrating on what? It might be like, well, they don't do this thing called concentration like you do.
So right.
It's yeah, less it's a different important. Thing. What do you mean on what? It could also be on an apple, but the way they cogitate upon a platonic apple is much different than the Westerner concentrating on an apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So, and whether that attempt to concentrate is through a bodily function or process such as with yoga or honing in on concentration of the highest deities with other techniques, the shared goal is more or less a direct quote from Haas.
To collect the mind forces in one point, and in so doing, give the mind back to itself and to the mind of which it is a manifestation. Yes. Give the mind back to itself.
Yeah, basically focusing on pure subject, pure consciousness. So this concentration on what question thus becomes merely a technical problem regarding how sages and schools differ, but whilst their motive and goal remain basically the same. So this supreme unifying goal of knowledge and the divine asserting itself in the mind, struggling toward that aim, that is what the concentration is on in the East.
All right. I'm grasping this, but, and I can't help but get the sense, a very similar sense to my own, actually, that in Haas recognizing how differently the Eastern mind works, and I'm not suggesting anyone's fetishizing the Eastern mind, but it's sort of like you can't help but notice the way you have to point out the upsides, right? To collect the mind forces in one point, and in doing so, give the mind back to itself and to the mind of which it is a manifestation. To reach that state of, or to take that approach of the Eastern equivalent of concentration, I must say, it sounds pretty attractive.
Well, yeah, and it sounds attractive to a lot of the white Westerners that buy into yoga and meditation and all this other transcendental religious stuff as well.
Yeah, I can hardly think that is what he's referring to, but you're right. Yeah. In other words, it can be repackaged as product under capitalism, and then it becomes its bastardized, watered down form. I bet you they never even address the differences in Western and Eastern minds while they're peddling that nonsense.
Well, yeah, they can't, because they have to trick everybody into assuming that everyone's minds are the same.
Ah, that's right. This is, and thus you can become like a great yogi or whatever.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So now what about this? You've already mentioned this process of dismantling in pursuit of pure consciousness. Where does Haas go with this?
Well, yeah, that's similarly to how Haas explained that process of dismantling in the last chapter, this pursuit of pure consciousness. The manifest meaning of Eastern concentration is a process of becoming, a transformation of the subject accompanying a recognized state in which there's nothing outside the subject to be known.
Okay, that's interesting. Haas says, in the whole process, nothing accrues to man. On the contrary, something is being taken from him. This is the illusion of his own selfhood and the reality of the world. Instead, he is restored to what he really is, before and beyond his individual existence. This is his conversion to the real, capital C conversion to the capital R real.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a note about that a little bit further on, but Haas explaining this process, he calls it the systematic dismantling of the normal ego. and therewith the corresponding phenomenal world. So as consciousness is emptied, a void is produced. Not considered to be a negation, the void which is created at the price of tremendous effort leads to the state of pure consciousness. And Haas employs several designations here, such as light, bliss, identification with the divine, and nirvana. But he accepts the deficiencies of language to describe more accurately. And considering the resulting state to be the consummation of the Eastern mind structure, Haas expresses an understanding that our Western mind concept of subject likely can't match the emergence of the Eastern subject in their pure consciousness state, only ever to be realized through experience, which we can't have. So, since the Eastern structure posits the subject first, it can never conceive of consciousness as being intrinsically connected with an object. And Haas says this is crucial. So, making a distinction between consciousness and awareness in the Eastern mind, Haas points out that a coexistence with some sort of present or potential contents, remember that means held within boundaries, typically signifies consciousness, while the mind being detached from all and restored to itself is better defined as awareness. Hmm. You want to read that definition of awareness from Haas?
Let's do it. It implies that there can be awareness without anything of which awareness is aware, hence a state of pure lucidity.
Yes.
Lucidity.
Yeah, so this is where I noted, I suspect the reason Haas has been capitalizing the real, in some instances, for the East, is to represent the split between a lowercase r real world, which is represented by those potential contents accompanying consciousness, as he just mentioned, and the capital R real, approximating this pure consciousness state of awareness or pure lucidity. That's probably what he means by conversion to the real.
Right. And it was capital C conversion, right? So it's very active. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because conversion implies, at least to me, that it's not exactly a complete diametrical transmutation or transformation. It's just a shift.
Okay, so you mentioned this example of awareness, which is in the reach of everyone, within the reach of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, Haas mentions one example that's universal, or at least he considers it such. So basically a gift of particular circumstances that escapes attention by nature. Haas mentions that fleeting, almost imperceptible moment, which sometimes comes between sleep and full awakening. A sudden flash of lucidity is experienced before the exquisite state is eclipsed by the inner and outer objects of our surroundings and concerns. And Haas says the very existence of such a state as this carries a certain guarantee that consciousness without an object can exist. And I've definitely experienced that, so I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, I was about to agree. Yes. And it isn't just actually before or after a sleep state. You can also get this with when you're having like one of these 5-minute thoughts and you're thinking like, okay, yeah. And then this, yeah. And then that connects to that. And then this is similar to that. And no, let's throw that away. When you're going through that process, at least for myself, this is when, if I'm interrupted, I get a serious case of, deja vu. And that's an example where your mind is probably misfiring those associations you were making. And, begins to attribute great meaning to random stimuli around you because you're in that pattern of connecting dots that you were filtering for importance. Just a thought. In other words, your brain can do these things. It can give you these little gifts, which are like insights into perhaps how other, how Eastern minds work.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with perception. So like you said, it's if your perception kind of slips out of time for a second, it make things seem a lot clearer or a lot more distant when they were right there in your mind, a particular magnitude or a particular distance from your thoughts. It's like they slip out of place. So, yeah, it is interesting for sure. And for me personally,
this can't really be compared with pure consciousness, though, right? That's like a next level type of.
Haz is saying this is like a flash of it. So it's like we get a taste of this exquisite state for a split second. Uh-huh. And the most common comparison for me personally is if I were kind of sleepy, but I was in the middle of doing something, and then you kind of nod off for a second and wake up, but you don't know if you were actually asleep.
Yes.
This explains it perfectly to me.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Or sometimes you have that and you're not sure you slept. You're not sure you slept, but you have a new idea. Like that happens too.
Yes.
Yeah. You're like, oh, everyone's had that. It's the weirdest feeling when you wake up and you've solved a problem while sleeping.
Yeah.
Interesting. And for those wondering, the problem solved is usually you're like, oh yeah, the rope has to be 6 feet long, and you kick the chair out. Anyway, I'm noticing, by the way, this is a good time to just see if FTJ is working, because I can't seem to get the list of shows, but I'm thinking at least Odyssey would certainly have more participants in the chat. Hey to the chat real quick.
All right.
And, oh, there's another way to get to the live show for FTJ. There we go. Hopefully it comes up. Oh, interesting. All right. Looks like FTJ is having some minor loading issues. Or it's my browser. I'll figure that out momentarily. In the meantime, look what we have over here at... yes, there it is. Odyssey pulling up. By the way, Rumble very slow. Entropy is still working, but Rumble's working. Just no one's saying hey, which is probably a blessing. We don't want the trogs there. But Odyssey is packed, so Odyssey, as usual, a great chat.
Right. Well, hey, hello. Welcome to the stream, everybody.
It just never, It never ends. It's always something. So, how are you guys? Welcome. Who do we have here? We got
Serbian Bull, brr, nigger. We have Luke Notaris in there, of course. Captain Koshiro, nice to see you. Kick Chef, MFC NorCal Vengeance. What's up, buddy? And having mentioned Helgon, what are you laughing about, Luke?
This is funny. Kick Chef and Vengeance are calling me an NPC. That's funny.
I see that. You need a new brain, they say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just the way your brain works. You work in different, let's just call it, you have a different conceptual language. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder so if
Vengeance you ever taken in by that Face of Mars business? Probably not, right?
I don't even know what you're talking about. Some pareidolia thing?
Yeah, the face on Mars, right? People convinced it's a face on Mars. You weren't taken in by that. I would imagine not, right?
No.
Right. Okay. Well, there's people who, it's not even their fault, dude. I'm telling you, it's because of the way their brain works. They see this stimuli and they immediately say like, yeah, dude, that's a face. Everyone can see that. And just like, you're like, no, I don't see a face. In fact, I close my eyes. I can't even picture the face you're referring to.
Yeah.
So there you go.
If it's a face, made of sand or something? Yeah, it's a siliceous inanimate object. It's not a fucking face.
Exactly. And but, Serbian Bull saying wanking off helps concentration. Oh, thanks for the tip. Yeah, that's great. All right. You were going to say, I've interrupted you though, Luke. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just curious if Vengeance wasn't given this terminology to use by someone else, NPC, I wonder what he would call me instead. Something more creative.
Yes, right. Well, of course, he's just breaking balls. But yeah, NPC, in fact, is that's more of a set of characteristics to describe someone who doesn't engage with culture the same way you do, right? I mean, pretty much that's the insult, right? So in that way, I could say, yeah, you know what? Compared to people who are totally online and stuff, yeah, maybe I probably really do come off like an NPC. Because I'm like over here thinking about my own stuff. And stuff I think's important. And then someone else is like, what? You didn't see the latest meme? It's got, you know, the dog versus the Pop-Tart cat. And you're like, what? Anyway, so you'd be an NPC because you didn't know about the dog versus the Pop-Tart cat.
I guess. Well, hopefully I'm doing something cool like selling swords or something in the game.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That'll be my role as the non-player character. I can just be the book merchant.
Yeah, you're waiting, right, you're waiting in the alley after selling swords. You're waiting for the beer wench. Mm-hmm. So, that's NPC right. Or not, Luke be getting some after selling swords. Just one last sword to sell her. All right, so.
Davis, I can't picture it vividly when I close my eyes, so I'm an NPC.
Yeah, see, you have non-brain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they'd say. Hopefully you're not an NPC that can be killed for the sword. Oh, is that a thing in games that some NPCs can be killed and some can't? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. See, I don't even know. Dude, I haven't played video games in so long. Yeah, I mean, I do understand the NPC thing, but only in a really limited way.
Oh, Helgan, the white nigger, doesn't want to pay up. He just wants to get it for free.
Ah, he wants to kill you for the sword instead of paying
right.
6,000 for the katana.
That's right.
Yeah, there could be only one NPC. No, actually, that's the point.
That's good. NPC's Highlander.
Yeah. Highlander. Yeah, the only Highlander around in this scene is probably the Highlander of the Trogs, where there can be only one Puerto Rican who pretends to be white. And everyone's like, yeah, thank God, there's only one. Exactly.
One too many.
Lowlander in that case. All right, well, we've done it, and we sure are glad the Odyssey chat is working. They're sticking with us. Hey, by the way, those who haven't heard the prior chapters, this book is very much a developmental approach to understanding comparison between the East and Western mind. So avail yourself of all the prior chapters. Feel free to stick with us live, but it would serve you well to go listen from the beginning to the other episodes, and then maybe play catch up, or at the least by the time we might have concluded, go back and backfill your understanding with the earlier chapters. So they're all available on FTJ. I believe they're all available on Odyssey as well, and anything we've done live is available on Rumble. But just go to FTJ or Odyssey. Everything from the first chapter up is on there. Okay.
Yeah. So. And eventually when we're done with the whole book, we'll try to edit it, package it, and upload it where it's just one cohesive selection.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There's no try to about it. Yep. That's the point. That's what we're going to do. Almost like there's only one Alex Linder, but almost like an Alex Linder approach to a book where, you don't just read passages, but you talk about it, you convey your thoughts, and you offer critiques and comparisons and connections. Yeah. Although Alex Linder did a lot more of the verbatim reading, I would dare say I like Luke's approach better, where he takes the book in and then he tells it back to you in a way that's easier to understand, highlighting the author's original intent with key quotations instead of lengthy passages where people can get lost in that, So anyway, I'm just applauding Luke on his approach. I think it's superior to just about anything else I've heard as far as a book talk goes. So bully on Luke. Too bad, Luke, you can't do this full time. Wouldn't it be great to force you to quit your job and have you reading books all day, every day, like some kind of intellectual slave? You'd have to constantly be reading these books and doing book talks.
Yeah, well, it does help. Like I've expressed to you before, and I appreciate the compliments, but yeah, having you and this opportunity to discuss with you catalyzed me to read this, because I had this book saved already. Same with Simpson, which was the first book we did, Which Way Western Man. I wanted to read it, and I would just get distracted. I would come home from work, I'd be exhausted. This is the last thing that I'd want to do. So being able to disseminate this message, I feel like it gives it a lot more meaning, but it also lights a fire under my ass to actually do the work. So I appreciate it just as much as you do.
Ah, yes. Well, and we've had a lot of positive emails, so I know others do as well. All right, excellent. Not anymore.
I can't visualize the apple, so I just lost all my fans.
Yeah, exactly. They're on like, fuck, Luke. That's what they're saying now. That's right. Yeah, they thought he was all right, but now they're not so sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So now, have we discussed... Well, let me just reread this quote. We took a big diversion. So easiest way to do this is to reread this Haas quote. This is, again, about the existence of states of mind, you know, this difference between conversion to the real, capital R, et cetera, et cetera. So... the last thing we quoted, if I'm correct, is the very existence of such a state as this carries a certain guarantee that consciousness without an object can exist. Or am I way off?
Yeah, that's exactly where we left off. Mm-hmm. Right, because Haas was talking about this fleeting, almost imperceptible moment, which sometimes comes between sleep and full awakening. And that's the state that he's referring to.
Good. Okay.
Acknowledging that this description cannot be compared with the state of pure consciousness, which marks the peak of the Eastern Way, Haas considers both states to be of the same generic character. So, serving as an indication, even in the Western mind, such lucid flashes seem to prove that a state of pure subject or pure consciousness is possible. However, the transformational aspect in which the whole being undergoes a replacement of subject with pure consciousness remains ever beyond the reach of the Western mind. And that is because of our inherent possessive form of knowledge, where we're always tempted to turn toward anything the subject possesses.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, Haas says, thus, that which signifies fulfillment for the East would mean annihilation for the West. The Eastern Way is only open to the West as an intentional desire, which ignores the conditions of pure reality of its own and the East's existence. I'm going to need your help with that.
Yeah. Well, I thought about this for a bit. And always, as always, Haas's thesis does track here. So when I put myself in this conditional hypothetical of suddenly becoming pure subject, or pure consciousness, my thought process was, okay, cool. I'm now pure subject, pure consciousness, which means I'm connected to everything, right? The essence, the all, the absolute, the real, capital R. This is great. So what do I actually have up in this bitch? You know, where is this? Where am I? I just said it. Like, damn it, I already did the thing. So unavoidably, my first and only interest was in all of the associated objects as accumulated possessions, physical or psychological. I can't even conceive of being pure consciousness, pure subject, completely unconnected to any object, because I wouldn't even know what I am. And yeah, I wouldn't even mean anything.
Yeah, the reference point is I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's right. He's saying that this transformational aspect in which the whole being undergoes a replacement of subject with pure consciousness is not doable for Western minds. It's just out of the question.
Now, Haas says, here, in this almost invisible yet momentous instant, we see both structures at work. When the Western structure seems to approach the state of pure consciousness, there will always arise an irresistible temptation to experience this state as a possession. Mm-hmm. The subject would want to emerge from behind the state to assure itself of its attainment.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I dare say there's not a Western man alive who would be able to say he's wrong.
Right, which is the point, right? This is the great distinction between the Eastern and Western mind. Again, Haas is doing it again.
Yeah. Quite well, as usual.
Yes. I mean, he's definitely thought about this, and he's scaffolding it for us. There's never too many big ideas at once. I would dare say, though, this is like one of those forehead slappers, like, oh, yeah. Like, this proves... this proves in one way, by the way, I think that the Eastern and Western mind in this respect are very complementary. So, you know, if there weren't the Jew constantly acting as the middleman to invoke confusion and indifference or even war between peoples of the East and West, as they do with people of the West and West, just what a different world this could be.
Yeah.
Imagine the power of a complementary way of thinking to all the world's problems. Wow.
Yeah, I can't imagine it because I'm so used to what it actually is, which is completely diametrically opposed to any kind of harmony or peace at all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Because peace currently is now only defined as the absence of resistance to the will of Jews. So the true peace we will never have until you're rid of that agitating element.
That's right.
All right. So it goes on to discuss these ecstatic states of mystics and what supreme knowledge they may engender. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So after saying that, this is pretty much pure consciousness, pure subject out of the question for the Western mind. Mm. Haas mentions these great Christian mystics and the act of supreme knowledge carrying an accompanying experience. So either they possess God or God possesses them. And there's that possessive knowledge again. The untiring expressions of such religious mystics, rendering accounts of such efforts to themselves and others, reveals an unmistakable insecurity that Haas calls inevitable. And I noted here, recall the Western uncertainty that Haas elucidated in Chapter 2. As time progresses, that uncertainty has only grown, and we feel more enigmatic and doubtful to our essence and value, uneasy with no clear road or objective. Hence, our search for equilibrium through philosophy and this dreaded loop, from metaphysics to science to sensorial experience to psychology, ad infinitum, it just goes on forever. So in this context, the uncertainty comes from the fact that no matter what the definition of unio mystica, mystical union, like from the early Christian idea of becoming one with God or the absolute, in some aspect and to some extent, there will always be a distinction between divine and human substances, just like subject-object distinction.
Mm. And to this end, Haas says, to the Eastern mind in general, and the Indian in particular, such an embarrassment not only does not exist, it apparently is meaningless. What to the West is a crucial problem shrouded in insoluble mystery is to the East the unproblematic consummation of a long and clearly ordained path.
Yes. So although the actual state itself contains nothing mystical, it's still considered supernatural to the Western mind. And what makes the Eastern unification with the divine substance so mysterious to the West is the fact that their individual souls remain distinguished from the divine, as well as every other soul sharing similarly in the union. And that identity in the Eastern mind structure, which is destined to overcome the juxtaposition, things, is evinced here, where contradiction is A-okay in their contemplation and concentration. Since pure consciousness equals pure being, all that's required is a simple transformation to that end. And I noted again, remember Haas's earlier distinction regarding the Eastern mind's sovereignty in contradistinction to the Western, where he said it retains the freedom to deal with itself and undergo transmutation. So compared with this ineffable characterization of mysticism, such as the disappearance in disappearance, fana fi il fana in Sufi Islam mysticism, concepts presented through imagery to the Eastern philousia are auxiliary, just to be contemplated but not considered necessary for transmutation through their dismantling process because they retain that sovereignty. That's why it's so different from our own mind.
Yes. Yes. Boy, is it. And so now there'll be a shift to focus on the affect portions of this unification idea, AFFECT, the affect portions of this unification idea.
Yes. Yeah. And that would be like emotional deportment, you know, your mannerisms, your feeling, basically, your affect. So necessary also is an affective character in accompaniment with both Eastern and Western notions. It regards the fundamental ideas of love in the West, the Greek eros and the Christian caritas, which would be charity, and their corresponding Eastern ideas. So although eros and caritas seem contradictory, in a way they complement and complete each other. And Plato's Symposium is mentioned, where Socrates describes eros gradually rising from the love of beautiful bodies to the love of beautiful souls, culminating in the love of beauty itself, the idea of beauty. And that's yet another good example of objectivation through philosophy, resulting in a concept constructed within contents. It's all very Western.
Very Western, yeah.
Both mind and spirit work in tandem for this movement, approximating intuition regarding what is beautiful. And the counter movement is found in Christian love, which Haas describes. You want to read it?
Yes. It has its origin and... It has its origin and seat in God, and it moves down to the fullness of his creation, embracing man, not as a species, but every individual in his own right. By nature and origin, this love is selfless and free from desire. It is a love of deep understanding and of compassion for individual man.
Yes, yeah, and that's the focus, individual man. So this concept of reaching up above to the divine from below signifies a priority of praising and loving God. Love for one's fellow man is more like a duty than a spontaneous movement. But resulting from the belief that every man is created in the image of God, every man thus has claim to his fellow man's love as a God-created immortal soul, irrespective of his rank and value. And such is caritas, the Christian love, charity.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, and Haas says, thus it follows, in the West, the perfect act of love centers on the individual. And this is because the individual is more than a mere phenomenon of nature, which represented as the supreme beauty in Greece, which I noted, it's like Buenos de Milo or Aphrodite of Melos, this ideal beauty, holding the apple of discord dropped from Eros to the fairest or most beautiful. And in Haas's words, he says, in Christianity, it's the immortal image of God.
Hmm. Now, before I proceed with this Haas quote, I have questions. Well, you may not have answers to them because maybe it's not an understanding you came away with from Haas, but it's got me thinking about the Eastern mind. So, I mean, listen, we know how the Western mind does in fact walk through the process of a love of beautiful bodies. And then you can come to know that person with the body you enjoy, and then you fall in love with their beautiful soul. And this culminates in somehow the love of beauty itself, which to the Western mind, of course, is the idea of beauty. And then you just want to surround yourself with beauty. You find it advantageous. You find it peaceful. So all that I get, but then, so the East, let me get this straight. The Eastern mind, does this mean they love differently? Does this mean like they don't fall in love the same way? Does this mean the Eastern mind doesn't objectify a beautiful Asian woman?
Yeah, well, actually, Haas has a portion later on that's kind of comical, and it's a direct answer to this. So that's why I'm chuckling.
Oh, okay, good. Well, we can wait then. Yeah, because I was just thinking, like, what the hell is he saying? Is he saying that we don't even understand how these people walk through the normal steps of falling in love and things like that? But
no,
good. We'll find out more about that.
Yeah, just like as a prefatory statement, Haas does make the distinction between the natural biological love as to be understood in like a stage play or a novel or, you know, yeah, he's basically saying it's like a biological thing. Without that kind of love, there would be no propagation of the species. And that's not what he's referring to. So he's talking more about these prerequisite portions for seeking this unification through concentration. He's saying love can be a catalyst, but he's specifying the Western distinctions of charitable love and this much stronger, more raw primal love as just being, yeah, fuel.
Yeah, but he is discussing it in terms of like a platonic, like a version of love that everyone can understand. So he's already objectifying the thing, but to describe how we objectify it, I'm just saying.
Well, like that's he says,
the confusion.
In the West, the perfect act of love centers on the individual because the individual is more than a mere phenomenon of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's saying this draw or this pull to be attracted in the way that you're thinking would be phenomenon of nature. That's how he's making the distinction. And he's saying these are separate, different.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Yep. Yep. And it can feel like a phenomenon of nature. That's for sure. Haas says, in either its religious or secularized form, love preserves its character of action and is directed toward the personality center as its aim.
Yeah. So action in this context would be like the Socratic concept of eros rising from carnality to reverence for the objectified idea of beauty, or the charitable action to one's fellow man as praise due to God being the common antecedent of all individual men.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of goes along with it's like a catalyst, you know, spurring you to action.
Makes sense. Yes. Okay.
Yes. And Haas says that both Greek and Christian ideas of love are foreign to the East, not relying on conceptual thinking as their vehicle of reality. The East presents analogies, but not affinities to the Western ideas. And starting with India, Haas mentions kama, defined as an endless desire for existence and its pleasures. So when the recognition of that endless desire flares insatiably, it awakens in the enlightened mind a thirst for liberation from such bondage, for oneself and one's fellow creatures. An accompanying infinite compassion rises in rival magnitude with the desire, but isn't restricted to man alone because it comprises all that lives. So it's not about the individual as in the Greek and Christian idea.
So now he's about to get into these different ideas of compassion with more specificity.
Yeah. So starting with the Christian idea, because he's saying it's essentially different from the Indian idea, compassion, the Christian compassion derives directly from God's passionate love of man. And the result is therefore a concomitant manifestation of love, which aims directly at the immortal soul of man as an individual.
Mm-hmm. As to the Buddha, he recognizes that all-pervading compassion coupled with the right insight into the vanity of the world constitutes the only power which can lead to final liberation from the sufferings in this world and those of future reincarnations.
Yeah, and we've kind of talked about that before, like, the absence of desire equals the absence of suffering. But it's nice to see this in context where Haas is making the distinction, because he's saying this concept of suffering and the compassion of wanting to eliminate it isn't just for yourself or an individual man like your friend. It's for everything that lives.
Yeah. So,
pretty cool.
Yeah.
And Haas also mentions that even in the Bhagavad Gita, translations of bhakti into love diminishes the true significance. So in full context and atmosphere, a fervent devotion should be the defining characteristic of this bhakti notion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I actually researched that, this word, the origin, what it actually means, the true definition. And bhakti is indeed much more than just love. So according to philologists such as Monier Williams, who wrote a Sanskrit dictionary in 1899, he says that bhakti means attachment, fondness for, devotion to, trust, homage, worship, piety, faith, and love. And in Indian religions, it may also refer to loving devotion or a personal god like Krishna, a formless ultimate reality like Brahman, or an enlightened being like Buddha, Bodhisattva, or a guru. So this bhakti is often a deeply emotional devotion based on a relationship between a devotee and the god potentially making moksha or nirvana possible.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's...
This, yeah, this is next level here because this is like, I mean, love, this is next level. Like, this is a religious endeavor. This is a transcendental endeavor. Because, I would dare say, sure, this has to be entirely religious in its outlook. I worship?
Yeah. It's like worshipful reverence, deeply emotional devotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and speaking of the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna, Haas presents a portion of Krishna's speech from Bhagavad Gita, the ninth book and the 29th verse, where Krishna says, "I am indifferent to all born beings. There is none of whom I hate, none whom I love. But they that worship me with devotion dwell in me and I in them." So notice how this god, Krishna, does not and cannot ask to become the object of love. And Chinese dispensations of supreme and adequate objects of love are equally deficient, says Haas. So the emphasis is laid on social virtues such as devotion, reverence, dutiful respect, friendship, and the like, exalted in theory and practice in public and private life. It's basically just emotional attitudes offered to the spirits of the ancestors, the emperor, the parents, the scholars, and so forth. Yeah. And this is where, go ahead.
It's striking me now that actually this is not as foreign as I thought it would be.
Yeah.
So I'm indifferent to all born beings. There's none of whom I hate, none whom I love, but they that worship me with devotion dwell in me and I in them. It's striking me that a Jew could have written this. It's very transactional. There's almost like a commerce of worship. It's like, and they've structured their society in such a way that they all endeavor to hypothecate their worship and devotion to Krishna or ancestors or whatever they're doing. I would say Christian society, not being critical, I'm just stating a fact that Christian society very much has, failed to do something similar, like a similar equivalent to Jesus or the Trinity. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, when I think about it, if they're dwelling in and they're dwelling in you, it can't be Jew because no goy could be conjoined. It'd make them unclean.
Oh, that's true too. Yes, right. Yeah, that's true. Also, it's only extraction, not transaction when it comes to the Jew. That's true.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd get nothing for it but pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
See that? Well, now that was interesting. All right, so now... You're about to make note of this. By the way, why is Krishna an important figure at this point in the book to discuss? And it was particularly regarding this deep emotional state of devotion and all of that.
I think because this is one of the central figures with whom this concept of bhakti or this notion of bhakti is associated.
Which is the place and origin of the religion that became imported into China, right?
Well, yeah, a lot of the Sanskrit texts that are now foundational for Hinduism were also the origin of Buddhism, like the Mahayana tradition, which proliferated in China from Fujian and Yunzhong. So, yeah, this Bhagavad Gita is different, I guess, from the Upanishads, and it's like a split off where it's more specific to Hinduism as opposed to Buddhism. But this bhakti concept, even though it's Indian, is probably very similar to Buddhist aspects as well, similar to like moksha and nirvana being pretty much the same thing, even though they're in different religions, because they had similar origins.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I think that's why Haas kind of rolled this, the Chinese dispensations of supreme and adequate objects of love are equally deficient, because they don't focus on the individual or the object. It's more about that conjoining, you know, an actual spiritual worshipful reverence and devotion turning into affinity and correspondence.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you clarified. So it isn't, this isn't a case where Haas is looking to the source material to help us better understand a larger aspect of the Eastern mind. Instead, he's doing a reading upon the parallel resource, the parallel sources, and showing again how alike these aspects of the Eastern mind are. So I see what he's doing, but thank you for the clarification then, right? Not source material, instead, parallel material in India of a different sort. Yep.
Yeah. And just to make it super distilled and clear. So Haas is saying the West has these forms of love, the strongest of which are Eros and charity.
Mm-hmm.
And that would represent the ancient Greek idea of beauty with Eros from Socrates. And caritas, like this charitable Christian notion. But if you say, well, they still love in the East, right? What about this bhakti thing? And that's why Haas is saying, well, this is what bhakti is. It's not exactly the same thing. And the biggest difference is the compassion in the East is more about compassion for every living thing. And if you can connect with this emotional devotion to Krishna, for instance, you have to assume that everybody else is also connected to Krishna. So in so doing, being connected to Krishna means you're connected to everyone else around you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the compassion is like universalistic.
Right. And again, this is what the East likes to think about itself. This, we realize this is not true for every Indian or every Asian. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird because it seems almost paradoxical to the Western mind, like we've talked about before, seeing live leak footage from China where children drown in the pool and then people just step over them, or people touch a live wire and get cooked in the street and people just ignore it, walk right over them, car crashes where people get killed. And it's like, well, where's the compassion for his fellow man?
Yeah.
But when you think about this lack of interest in compassion or love for the individual, because they care more about the affinity and correspondence of the amalgam of all living things, it does become a little bit clear. It seems weird to us.
Yes, right. Yeah, so explain something, but still, the familiarity is, the lack of it is often breeds contempt, right? So,
right.
Yeah. Not really getting how they interact with each other, but you can say it works for them. This remoteness, this isolation, this self-sufficiency. Tell us more.
Yeah, and that is something, the isolation. Haas does bring that up later, but somewhat comically, this is the point in the book where Haas mentions this love, as it corresponds to human nature, can't be considered disproof of the sovereignty and validity of the structure he just outlined. So like love stories and plays, or romance novels in India and China. And Haas says, for if all the phenomena of life and the mind were in unrestricted agreement with the structure, there would be nothing left but the straight road to fulfillment and fulfillment itself, a monotonous and inhuman spectacle. And I said, this was based because it's like Haas saying, well, I wouldn't have to write this book if it was that obvious. And he's preemptively reminding potential critics who may be inclined to do the, but what about such and such thing? He's also reminding the reader that it's worth digging into the guts of things for a greater understanding. Like, do we really want everything easy and straightforward and super obvious all the time? It sucks the challenge and the fun out of life when you choose not to chisel away. And it's like Haas says, a monotonous and inhuman spectacle. So I like that because it's like he knew people would descend on him for this. He, or at least suspected. And yeah, he did like a preemptive strike in a kind of a comedic way. So I like that a lot.
Interesting. Yes, yes, yes. And in fact, this may have a lot to do with the more pedestrian kind of love that I was questioning earlier. So these struggles that occur to form the bonds and all of that. I know our guys, they do complain about the ladies, but I think there's a reason. There's like a psychobiological reason why men and women are just so different that sometimes they're literally not speaking the same language. And it's because, like Luke just said, you don't want everything easy. Like literally, if pairing were easy, it would be devalued. So the very difficulty you find in matching with a mate is the thing that makes it durable once it happens. Right? So if you're like 8 weeks investing into a girl and you're like, oh, this, now it's become kind of tough. We're not sure if we're going to get past this. Just focus on getting past it, because the very second you, the very second you can come to terms of agreement and understanding about your future together, like that's when it all locks in and becomes enduring. But sure, it's meant to be, in other words, it's meant to be a pain in the ass, because, you know, nothing is intended to come easy, just as you wouldn't want your ability to consider complex ideas and stuff like that to be, to just come easy. Like literally they would not be recognized as more meaningful than dumb ideas if they came easy.
Right. Yeah. And that ties in with what Haas is getting at, and especially what he gets at next, like the importance of doing exactly like you said, doing the work to rectify those issues when they arise, if it's in a, you know, intersexual dynamics or anything else. The space that that occupies in importance in the West is so much more important. It's so much broader than in the East, because they have this completely different notion. So yeah, I mean, it all tracks and I like it.
Yeah, as usual, Haas is tracking. So recaps and reminders from Haas before we proceed.
Yeah. Well, before that, Haas kind of rounds that last portion out about love, because he says these realizations or manifestations of the Eastern structure actually radiate everywhere. And while determining the atmosphere of the civilization, there's still ample space for the abortive and the imperfect, touching the all too human, but imperceptibly.
Right. I'm sorry. I missed this bit. Yeah. Okay. So Haas said the place conceded in the East to love in general, and to that between the sexes in particular, together with its factual significance, can hardly be compared to the space and appreciation it holds in the West.
Yes.
Well, so he's just gone and said it. Yep.
Yep. And he gives a concluding example to his analysis of love and how it pertains to the goal of concentration. So Haas contrasts East and West again, characterized by a remoteness, isolation, and self-sufficiency, the Eastern sages still embrace a universal compassion that allows a life of sacrifice and the sacrifice of life. But universal compassion turns to the individual case of one among the many. Whereas the Christian universal love contrarily seizes upon the individual case as unique, So Christian saints form bonds with men by being not only there for all, but there for each man as an individual. And that's the distinction.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yes. Christianity, in this example, is very Western.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now we'd be at the point where, before proceeding, there are some essential reminders and recapitulations. Let's have those.
Yeah, so I kind of truncated and just distilled this down to a few important points from Haas, because he does a pretty lengthy recap. But the first point is, being self-contained and not theoretical, the Eastern cognition, which would be like the gathering up of knowledge, is best described as a form of being. Like the concept, the Western idea, it possesses its own inherent dynamics, but with a specific difference. The concept is oriented to the object, whereas the state does not point beyond itself, that pure subject, pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the East concentrates on consciousness as such, whereas the West is interested in the content of consciousness. And that's an important point to make that distinction clear. Because the difference would be, exploring consciousness in the East depends on realizing states, like traversing the levels of knowledge by way of dismantling. And in the West, probing consciousness requires genuine concept, objectivity. Mm-hmm. So knowing the ultimate goal of both Eastern and Western knowledge, each can now be expressed as that of pure awareness in the East against pure idea in the West, mind facing itself.
Mm-hmm. So the discussion of cognition now, Haas reminds us that the Eastern establishment of pure consciousness is synonymous with the absolute subject. Tell us more.
Yeah, that would be the final state, remaining unknown until all dismantling is done and the experience is fully realized. And the West undergoes an uncharacteristic transmutation when cognizing mind becomes absolute object, taking itself as its only object, which similarly can't be fully known or understood until undergone. So both of these things that Haas is pointing out, pure awareness and pure idea, haven't been fully captured yet. They're still just concepts, they're exercises, they're things that everybody inevitably strives for, but haven't been fully fleshed out. This is just like the ultimate apotheosis of both East and West.
Right. So this is this is going to be everyone's journey, and very few actually have the destination, but yes. Haas sees the course of Western objectivation quite simply, which he presents with no difficulty in the following quote. Objectivation means a concreteness which finds expression in the ever-varying abundance of phenomena formed by demonstrable categories. Thus, there is no problem in understanding how and why the construction of the pure object bestows its character on Western civilization.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. He didn't have any difficulty, and he made sure to preface his statement with that, hoping that the reader feels the same way. But on the other hand, Haas explains that the pervading atmosphere and aspect of the East is more difficult to picture and understand. Hmm. So with the emphasis on subject, retaining its sovereignty, like you said earlier, the Eastern pursuance of its supreme destination requires a more subtle approach. And so,
pointing out that the Eastern civilization and the life within its structure is shaped by the attainment of pure consciousness, Haas then posits that such catalyzing power and will to concentration is a specific endowment to the East.
Yes. And this is kind of where I first started to realize Haas is saying this is like an autonomic function for the East, and they have to carry it out through subtlety, but it's not necessarily conscious. Like, they're just concentrating as a matter of course. So this thematic usage of endowment, again, in this context, inspired me to look back for more cohesive material from earlier chapters. And in Chapter 3, State and Society 1, Haas explained that Eastern Mind's power is remarkably efficient because of its subtle, conspicuous nature. And his actual quote was, "an immense concentration," as opposed to the West's distribution of energy by extension. And that was when he's talking about the intensive versus extensive energy of both. So later in that same chapter, Haas categorized Eastern civilization as driven by intensive energy in opposition to the West's extensive energy. And what we may consider as Eastern stagnation or excessive conservatism in the West is actually just efficiency. So it's clearer now with the added context of Eastern dismantling and their lack of alienation from object or other. It's easier to accept and understand that the East has a much less convoluted relationship with concentration. Changing their environment, their inner and outer environment, is a waste of energy. Eastern power is hoarded for the benefit of continued individual and societal preservation. So concentration is like the inherent tool that allows them to do this.
Huh.
I thought it was cool because it's something that Haas literally mentioned, the exact word, immense concentration, as opposed to the West distribution of energy by extension. He already hinted at this all those chapters earlier. So now he's just fleshing it out more.
Yeah, concentration being the inherent tool that allows all of this.
Yeah.
So Haas presents the likely temptation of the Western mind to subsequently ask two questions, which we did earlier. Concentration on what and concentration of what? But he says both miss the mark.
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of like he said earlier, the question doesn't have as much impact as you'd think. And now he explains why. So although a legitimate answer could be concentration on anything, or concentration on nothing, qualifying the Eastern concentration by defining it as concentration of attention or love is inaccurate.
And Haas says, such questioning ignores the fact that concentration constitutes the Eastern form of existence and gives it its indelible character. Another term for this concentration could be chosen, inner collectedness, which would indicate a state of being where the subject experiences itself as a universe in itself. As exemplified by true representatives, the Eastern mind is inclined to receive things, whatever their nature, as a whole.
Yes, as opposed to individual objects.
Inner collectedness.
So for the Western mind to concentrate on something, bringing it to the center, to hyperfocus, it has to be objectified in order for us to do that. And we have to self-abnegate so the focus on the subject is gone. And in the East, they don't focus on objectivity of a specific thing. They take all of the reality, lowercase r, around them and tune it out. So whatever they accept as they traverse these levels of consciousness through concentration and their effort, it's accepted whole, like Haas is saying.
So sometimes tuning it out could be, you know, stepping over that injured person in the street.
Right. Yeah.
Which is so foreign to us, but it's really because of our, it's because of our Western mind. And it's equally true then that these Asians you're watching step over just one Asian among many, they come by that mindset, equally so, quite honestly. I'm also struggling with this idea of this it's like an autonomic function, the way they sort and consider information, their engagement with problems. This is troubling me a bit. Maybe it's going to get cleared up. I don't know. But this seems like an evolutionary advantage that we should be jealous of. Like, wait a second. Their autonomic function, their autonomic ability has intelligence, because our autonomic abilities are limited strictly to functions like breathing and blinking eyes and the like.
Yeah, well, there's other inherent and innate characteristics that the Western mind exhibits that are just always there, and we can't avoid them. Sometimes we're not even aware of them. So Haas has already pointed that out.
So we just have a different set of autonomia. Okay.
Yeah. So like, whereas the body thing, I'm thinking about it more now, like stepping over the bodies, it just shows that Western civilization is even more fucked up than we thought. Because realistically, with this constructive idea, where we're taking the component parts of annihilated things and then making new stuff out of them, what we should be thinking if we walk over a dead body that nobody's claimed is, well, we can ground this up and then throw it into a diesel engine or something. Like, we can make biofuel. I'm sure everybody would think, well, that's kind of morbid. That's kind of disgusting even. Like, this is a person with a name and a family, and, you know, we should honor him and bury him or whatever. Unless it's a nigger, I guess, or a kike. But it's in the East. They don't have that same kind of feeling at all, because they're not focused on the individual, and they're also not doing the constructive thing. They're doing the destructive thing through this dismantling process. It's like, if it's not important for them, if it's not a necessary integral component for traversing these levels of consciousness or cognition, they can just ignore it.
Or at the very least, the threshold to leave that inner collectedness and consider the dead individual as an individual, that threshold is just different for them, because they, of course, do mourn their children and things like that. And these are the same people who would step over the stranger in the street. So I think it's just that the threshold is different, and the degree to which they inhabit that inner collectedness is very, very different. You know, seeing the receiving things, whatever their nature, as a whole. Yeah. I think they do engage in a bit of that Western personality driven type of objectification, especially in the loss of something like the loss of their child or whatever. Yeah, so I think they're more relatable than we think in some ways. So what do we have coming up next? We have a bit of a dialogue. You're going to be presenting a Zen story.
Yeah. Well, do you want to do the
student or the teacher?
Well, we could decide in a second. Do you want to do a break for chat? I'm going to go refill my coffee.
Oh, you're right. Yes, this would be a good time. Thank you. Yep. Thanks for the reminder. Break for chat. Okay. Oh, good. It looks like we've got a Bushmaster 6 hour. Okay. Luke's going for coffee, everybody. We're going to handle chat. So, right, yes, indeed. Let me pull up Billy88 has got a, how could we forget? Look at that. Hitler's birthday. Well, well, well. Isn't that nice? Okay. Well, I want to show you guys that. So let me go to present share screen. And wabam. 420. That's right. Thanks, Bill. That's nice. Bushmaster 6A says, been a busy weekend reporting for duty. Very good. Good to have you, sir. Bushmaster 6A further says, the Bajit sell their stores to family or friends before the five-year amortization period ends. So they never pay any startup costs. Oh, that's pretty slick. Us whites paid our blood tax for the country in these fake Jew wars. Send the blacks and the Latinos. Yeah, let's send them all back. Let's send the Bajits, the blacks, the Latinos. Let's send them all back. Or just elsewhere. Just away. Yes, I like it. All right, let's go over to F to the T to the J. And what do we have here? Oh, yeah, let's remind everyone we're going to have a break for chat. Mm-hmm. Right, that's what we're in now. And I've been terrible about reminding everyone to support the show, so I'm going to make sure I do that now. What do we have here? I'm trying to save this happy birthday Hitler thing, but like I'm going to pull this up next year. I'm going to stop saving that. That was a dumb idea. Okay. Me, ah, yes. Over to Odyssey. I don't think I lost many. Let me go back.
Well, hey, hello. Welcome to the stream, everybody.
It never ends. It never ends. It's always something. So, how are you guys? Welcome. Who do we have here? We got
Kick Chef, Strong by 55. Everyone else is still with us, of course. Let's see. Pug Lord Speaketh joined us. And Strong by 55. Helgahan. Desiring the absence of desire is a desire making it impossible. Well, that's interesting. I see what you did there. You're doing that thing where it's like you have the free will to decide, but not deciding at all. Is that really a decision? Anyway. Pug Lord Speaker says, consciousness requires an object in order to be experienced by the subject. Pure consciousness, by definition, can be experienced, but only in hindsight through thought and memory. Well, yeah, this is true, but this is, of course, a Western-minded description you're giving. Although you do cite here, Krishnamurti is the only guy to bust that open, but even he referred to it as pure organismic functioning. Organismic? Oh, boy, that's a lot of new words for me. His ability to do that resulted from a physiological transformation resulting from a freak absence of thought moment that caused the change. Oh, maybe this dude like damaged his own frontal lobes through, through yoga. See, they don't warn you about that when you're doing your goat yoga. Isn't that something the ladies in Calabasas do, goat yoga? All right. Anyway, Pug Lord says, Odyssey sucks, no donuts possible. Rumble sucks due to the high, due to the lack of character length. Oh, well, yeah, there's that too. Well, again, I put it in there. Go to Cash App. Go to Buy Me a Coffee, or even better, make an FTJ wallet. And then you can support all your favorite guys and girls. All right. And Anars joined us. What's up, buddy? And Heligan says, Indra is a protector of mankind in Hinduism, while the other Hindu gods are either indifferent or hostile. Oh, right, like Kali. Yes. Kali's case. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, well, what else can I say but support more of what you want to see in the world.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Fucking pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
I should probably remind you that Buy Me a Coffee is simple. It's Davis Lerman. So it's buymeacoffee.com/Davis Lerman. Over here, CoinTree, which is cointr.ee, you can go and offer Bitcoin shavings, Ethereum, or Bitcoin Cash. Likewise, not only is Cash App super easy because it's cash.app/$Davis Lerman, DAVISLURMANN, or, you know, QR code that bitch right there. But likewise, I've been remiss in showing everyone this. So this Banned by Amazon is a parallel bookshop to MTP, but the upside of Banned by Amazon is it has a payment processor for standard cards of all sort. So unlike Money Tree Publishing, which had its struggles in maintaining a consistent payment processor, Banned by Amazon, you could do everything on it. You can use anything you want. You can use crypto. You can also use bank and debit and credit cards. You can pay all kinds of ways. So do go to Banned by Amazon and the great thing is all the same codes apply. So it's still RPR, RPR for Right Perspective Radio, to get your discount. So go to Banned by Amazon. Have you noticed on FTJ, there's a little Banned by Amazon widget up there at the top of the screen. You click on that, it actually takes you right to Banned by Amazon. Let me see something. Let's go to MTP, Money Tree Publishing, together. No, it's not on here. Yeah, I guess that wouldn't make sense, but in a way it would make sense. It's all the same books and they all ship from the same place. So yeah, I might suggest to Dave Gahari that I have a Banned by Amazon button up here, at least a drop down. Then it could send people who might get confused on Money Tree, like, why can't I pay using my bank card? I could just avoid that by redirecting them to Banned by Amazon. There it is. Banned by Amazon. So again, all the same books, same code. Don't forget our guys over at Antelope Hill as well. Okay, let me leave this up there for a while since, that kid is just insistent. You grab your phone and then you do the QR code and then you...
Fuck you, pay me. We
heard you. We heard you. And then you dutifully reward your host. Mm-hmm. That's the plan anyway. Ah, look at this. We have Partizane here. Nice to see you guys. All right. So stick with us when Luke is back. We're going to continue with chapter 9. Wow. So
yeah, Davis, I'm back.
Good. Go back and listen to all the earlier shows. You can backfill your understanding of what is admittedly, some of this is pretty esoteric, but Haas makes short order of it and makes it quite understandable. Even if it is done through, inventing some new words, his neologisms can be a bit much. But once you've got the vocabulary down, the understanding follows. All right, Luke is back. So what was this about presenting a Zen story? I think I'm okay playing the student. Why not?
Well, I was going to say, since I played the dad in the Upanishad, you should be the teacher this time.
There you go. Good. I'll play the teacher.
Yeah. So this is a Zen story from Suzuki Daisetsu, Introduction to Zen Buddhism, New York, 1949. And
Suzuki Chan. Interesting.
Yes. Haas attempts to shed more light on this unification, preservation, and integrity of Eastern wholeness that he's been talking about. So in this story, a distinguished teacher is asked by his student, which will be me, do you ever make any effort to get disciplined in the truth?
Yes, I do.
How do you exercise yourself?
When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep.
That's what everybody does, but
no.
Can they be said to be exercising themselves in the same way as you?
No.
Well, why not?
Well, because when they eat, they do not eat, but they're thinking of various other things, thereby allowing themselves to be disturbed. When they sleep, they do not sleep, but dream of 1,001 things. This is why they are not like myself.
All right. Well, yeah, that's the story. And Haas is basically trying to point out that eating and sleeping require no intense concentration and even less effort to prevent being swept away by these occupations. So basically, emptying consciousness of all other content is this prerequisite, leaving only consciousness itself as content. And that defines the state of mind this teacher is elucidating in the story. And Haas chose this to remark the subtlety of action required in the achievement of this Zen state, along with a connecting aspect for his own thesis. The only content present being consciousness itself prepares for the presence of purer subject. So he thought this was a worthy parallel.
Yeah, so only presented as an exercise, the remarkable achievement of dismantling the other and reducing its existence to a mere presence points toward the ultimate realization of pure consciousness.
Yeah, so even though this is a natural, innate, inherent autonomic function of the Eastern mind, it can still be corrupted. It can still be distracted. There's still a lot of other things that could, draw your focus away from this pure consciousness exercise. So it's not like they're always Zen. They still have to work at it. They're just using the tool that's already there. They don't have to take another object, which would be the concept of concentration, like in the Western mind, and use it for that specific purpose. It's just always there, always running in varying degrees of magnitude.
Okay, well, that makes sense, right? This answers some of what I was asking earlier.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this story reminded me personally of like proverbs attributed to ancient Chinese wisdom that I've been told by teachers in varying contexts throughout the years, where they say, you got to empty your cup before you can fill it with something new. So in other words, it's like learning a new thing will always be arduous when constantly comparing it to things we already know, as opposed to emptying the cup first for a more accommodating mind state. And learning new languages is probably the best example of proof for this, where children without a solidified and practiced command of a particular tongue can pick up other languages much easier than adults who have extensive associative knowledge.
Yes. But how to do this emptying your cup business? It doesn't seem possible. Of course, you're always going to be comparing new information to something you know, or do the correlative linguistic thing where you're like, okay, this phrase means this in the language you already know.
Exactly. Yeah. So for the Western mind, it's a lot harder, even if it's something like, say you're working on a particular thing that you have, so like tinkering. If you're used to that, it might not translate to something else because you're constantly going to be comparing it. So when you start tinkering with another thing, you have to completely relearn everything from the beginning. You can't be trying to shoehorn what you already know and apply it to something where it's not applicable. Whereas to the East, it would be a lot easier for them to just just shrug off those things because it's just natural for them to do. Like, it's easier for them to divest and divert their focus onto a specific thing because they never really lost sight of how connected they were to it in the first place.
Okay, right. So this actually, and this fills in another blank I was wondering about earlier, right? So they're not always in this state of pure consciousness. It's not like they have this literal evolutionary advantage. It's more like, well, as I even said, where this is all these efforts, these would be achievements that only point toward the ultimate realization of pure consciousness. Not like they've reached it. Right. So this is more about the propensity of an Eastern mind. Well, just as the West has certain advantages that it's fitted for, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yes. From whatever angle the East is viewed, it presents itself in the fullness of its achievements as a system for preserving and increasing potential energy. Help us understand that.
Yeah, well, that's applicable to both Eastern man himself and his creations. So, to the Western observer, it seems like a mysterious restraining force is continuously basically just cock blocking the Eastern man from exteriorizing himself beyond a certain measure. Like he's marked off by his own aim or destination in life as opposed to his innate possibilities. But this mysterious force is simply the Eastern mind structure, evinced in one of many inexhaustible concrete manifestations.
Ah, Haas described it as an inner voice of warning. It tells Eastern man that it is wiser to accumulate vital energy than to waste it in the persistent pursuit of aims, of which the value is as uncertain as their number is endless. Such, at least, is the air which pervades Eastern civilization.
Yes. Yeah. And this goes along with what Haas outlined in earlier chapters, where he said there's like this conservatism and it can be misconstrued by the Western mind as excessive, or like maybe they're afraid, you know, to cut the ties and dive in the East.
Mm-hmm. But so conservative.
Haas is saying it's wisdom. Yes.
Yeah, oh, right. Exactly. Haas is saying it's wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he's saying they're basically taking all of this vital energy that could be squandered in the pursuit of all these unnecessary vagaries, you know, and aberrant behaviors. And instead they hoard it and they focus it, and it fuels their concentration in the pursuit of this goal of pure consciousness or pure subject.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because of that, the Western mind may be tempted to assume that Eastern man has suffered less injury in his soul over time than that of Western man. Although the West certainly risked more than the East for expansion and progress, the avoidance of such risks need not necessarily have a negative quality. So that Eastern inner voice of warning, like Haas says, may precipitate outcomes seemingly derived from wisdom. Like they save themselves a lot of grief by just avoiding.
Yeah, but it's not wisdom. It's not even an approximation of wisdom. It's just it's the way their mind worked that leads them to more conservative outcomes, less opportunistic, less improvised. Yeah, whereas the Western mind sort of has a knack for that. They'll go to the strange places. They'll go to the corners that seem like a waste of time. And they'll find something completely novel and new to feed that, you know, that ever-progressing novelty loop of creation, destruction, creation, destruction, creation, destruction.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Creation, destruction, improvement, creation, destruction, improvement. Yeah. Creation, right? That's actually what we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's high risk, high reward, but there's also a high chance that you get blown the fuck out. So
yeah.
I think that's where this approximation of wisdom is being chosen by Haas here, because he's saying to the Western mind, looking at the Eastern conservatism, we might say, man, these guys are like, yeah, too timid, too timorous. They're not doing enough. They're just, they're accepting their circumstances instead of trying to build bulwarks and break down barriers and explore. But also they suffer a lot less because of that, because they don't have to deal with the consequences of, like you said, going to explore that dark corner where demons might be lurking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, also known as Jews.
Exactly.
So we have, yeah. Right. So reminding us of the Western mind being impressed by the fundamental Oriental demeanor, Haas opines that the observations of a certain dignity, marking the bearing of men of rank and the common man as well, were likely rooted in the Eastern exhibits of intensive energy resulting from their endowment of concentration.
Yeah, so instead of being necessarily connected with high moral quality and value, Eastern dignity is strong enough to impose itself with a decorous attitude even when those inner prerequisites are lacking. And this is really interesting because Haas mentions a French naval officer who visited the Orient in the 1850s and recorded his own fascination with the Eastern dignity, shown through expressions of mannered gestures ordinarily inspired by nobility, but universally exhibited by all. And although not mentioning the officer's name or giving a source, Haas's inclusion of this character reminded me of Jules Brunet, who's definitely worth looking up for anyone interested. But Jules Brunet was a French officer sent to Japan as a horse artillery instructor in 1867. And after the Shogun was defeated during the Boshin War, Brunet defected and joined the Tokugawa Shogunate, playing a pivotal leading role in the separatist Azo Republic. So after the rebellion was defeated, he returned to France and fought further in the Franco-Prussian War, reaching the rank of division general before retiring. And that Tom Cruise character in The Last Samurai, the movie, was inspired by Brunet. So might have been who Haas was talking about.
It could very well be. That's wild. I thought that was entirely fictitious, that Last Samurai. That's amazing.
No. And the descendants of Jules Brunet, who are still living today, actually have the swords that he was gifted and that he used in battle.
Oh, damn. That's cool as fuck. Yeah.
So this dude was a certified badass because he fought in the Franco-Prussian War, reached that rank of general, and then he was in the Ministry of War in France after that. So he was a lifer. He fought a lot, and he went all over the world. So he documented his experiences in Mexico and throughout the Orient.
I wonder if he wrote enough to tease out of his writings an appreciation for the Eastern mind, or maybe even his Western mind becoming adaptive to the Eastern mind.
Well, I think because this is kind of the home stretch where Haas is making this final distinction between dignity and honor, This mention of this French naval officer, who we don't know who it was, it might have been this guy, but his understanding of the Eastern dignity was definitely like one of reverence and fascination and appreciation. So I don't think he was able to adopt it, but he still observed it, understood it, and expressed how impressed he was by it.
Right. This is an example where imitation is the highest form of flattery.
Right. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody today would just say, oh, this guy is a weeaboo faggot.
LARPer.
Exactly. But when you think about what he accomplished in the context of the time, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, dude. I mean, if he's a LARPer, he's a LARPing badass.
Yeah.
Well, shit. That is cool.
Yeah, and I think he's not the only one.
He's not the only one. Tell us more.
There were other Europeans who similarly did the same thing, like defected and fought in rebellions in other countries, and Japan was no exception to that. Just like there were British soldiers in World War II who defected and fought for Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, some of the next considerations are, being a Westerner, this is easy enough for understand considering what the Allies did to Japan, for example. So the fact that honor can be assailed and offended, yes, can it ever, but dignity is above attack. That's a neat way of contrasting, comparing them to really help the reader understand the difference.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really good. Haas finishes strong. So at the end of this chapter, Chapter 9, Concentration, Haas gives us another clear distinction between both minds, the Eastern dignity and the Western honor. So assuming that dignity occupies the place of honor in the East, its nature becomes apparent when compared. So honor can be assailed and offended. It may even be lost if not properly defended and the assailant called to account. Moreover, in the West, honor is often a class privilege, but dignity is above attack. It can't be defiled, and nobody in any station of life is excluded from sharing it. Whereas honor has the character of a possession, dignity is one with the person itself. Honor looks around in order to assert itself and be acknowledged, but dignity rests in itself and is self-sufficient. The inherent power of dignity is derived from the subject as its own point of reference.
Haas says, it is self-evident that concentration finds its climax and fulfillment in Fallujah. There it is at home. And it is appropriate to say that from there it descends and spreads, imbuing all the other strata of life.
Yeah, beautifully said, I think.
Oh, yeah. You can picture it.
Yeah, so just the concluding note, concentration is a tool that the Western mind can successfully employ, but in a much less innately integrated and unavoidably autonomic way than the Eastern mind. So although both ultimate culminations of Eastern and Western mind structures are currently unrealized, the paths are understood. And whereas Western extensive energy and constructiveness often manifests in tremendous post-concentration efforts, the Eastern demeanor of relative serenity with intensive embodiment of simpler concentration accomplishes a less conspicuous transformation, although no less impressive than the West. That was the best way I could kind of sum it up.
Indeed. So concentration finds its zenith and fulfillment of purpose in Fallujah, and from there it descends and spreads and imbues all the other strata of life. So this is like trickle down Fallujah, Eastern Fallujah.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah, that's interesting. And it does, you could see how, well, you could see actually, not only is it factual rather than counterfactual, but it also makes a great deal of sense that there's almost like this, you know, there'd be some external laws governing this process, you know, the same, like in this comparison, gravity would be forcing the descent and spread to imbue all the other strata of life. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So what did you, as far as the next chapter, art, artistry, and style, have you grasped now why he's going from chapter 9 to next consider art, artistry, and style?
Yeah, I don't know, because I didn't look ahead. The title is definitely intriguing, so I was curious, but I figured I would save it, so I'm going to delve into it more fully throughout this week. But he has made mentions of Eastern versus Western art, and they're just really short, one sentence here and there, you know, where he talks about the differences. So hopefully he delves into more specificity, because a lot of it was in prior context. It's all about nature and their integration with it. So like we've mentioned in previous sessions, the Western art is like the man, the subject facing off against the object around him, you know, somebody looking at a bunch of mountains, and the implication is like he has to conquer. Or it might be man enjoying something that he's built, like a big Colosseum, or standing in front of it. Mm-hmm. There's always that subject-object distinction, whereas the Eastern art has more of like a mix where there's man depicted as half animal, or moving like an animal, or integrated with nature somehow, with water or with stone or some approximation of those things. So yeah, I'm curious to see how Haas fleshes that out. Hopefully that's what it is.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, it's going to unfold.
Yeah.
And we can only have confidence in the writer thus far that it will make sense. We will gather understanding from it. So given some extra time now, I see that we have an opportunity to either explore a similar dialogue, the Schopenhauer dialogue, or, well, we know Bushmaster's in the chat. Perhaps you've got something to say about Bly's Iron Will. Iron John. Iron Will. And, either or. What I'll let you do is, are you okay taking the mic for a moment to consider those two? I'm going to myself get the coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Momentarily. Or I could play something as a break in the meantime. It's up to you.
No, I'd like to, at least thank Bushmaster for his recommendation of Iron John, because that was, it instantly caught my attention when I looked it up. So I downloaded the audiobook and I was listening to it throughout the week at work. I got about 7 or 8 hours into the 12-hour total, but I can definitely see the overlap in the context of Haas, especially last week, the session where you brought it up, Bushmaster. So thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait to finish the rest of it. I'm at the part right now where in the Iron John story, the golden-haired boy is working in the garden after coming up from his catabasis in the kitchen, and the king's daughter is looking down at him, catching sight of his resplendent hair and calling him up. He just brought flowers to her. And a lot of the stuff that Bly has mentioned has parallels with other things that I've read too, like this concept of no sword, no eros reminded me of George Lincoln Rockwell when he said, men who don't fuck, don't fight. And I thought, man, that's a really cool connective tissue. So based Papa Bushmaster once again, hooking us up with a really good book recommendation. And Bushmaster, while you're here, and I guess to everybody else as well, I'm curious to see if you've heard of an author named Ivor Benson, who was a Rhodesian, who wrote, I think, five or so books that are, of course, naturally shit on by Kikes as being anti-Semitic. But he gave some pretty good firsthand accounts of his experiences in Rhodesia and South Africa. So I thought if anybody has this dude's books, it's probably Bushmaster. So curious about that. See if you have them. Because I asked Davis, I assumed in Davis's vast library, he would have surely had an Ivor Benson book, but no dice. So.
All right. I see you've been chatting
away.
Welcome
back.
Yeah. Welcome back. Yeah.
I was just asking Bushmaster and anybody else in the chat if they have anything by Ivor Benson.
Good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder. Well, Bushmaster must, right? He's one that recommended it. He would likely have that.
Yeah. Well, the Ivor Benson was one of the authors that Oliver mentioned in The Jewish Strategy.
My mistake.
Yeah. That was the Rhodesian dude who had experiences in Rhodesia and South Africa.
Oh, right. Yes, you recommended this worldwide conspiracy and the Zionist factor, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, there was like five or so books. So I definitely want to dig into those and read them. But I figured, as always, if anybody else already has them, already read them, they can give us a rundown on if it's worth. That's one thing that I appreciate about you, is there are books that I've been interested in that you've already read, and you can say, oh yeah, I'll just give you the footnotes. You know, there's like two important parts to note, and then everything else in the book is just kind of like chaff. So that helps tremendously. It saves a lot of time. Yeah.
Yeah. The TLDR is really helpful.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Although sometimes there's the challenge where it's like, well, bad news, that doorstop called Which Way Western Man, each page is brilliant. So sometimes it's like that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And it's similar to Haas because, I think the PDF, I'll navigate and open it right now because I don't think it's really that long. But there's just so much stuff jam packed in it.
Right.
Okay. It's 361 pages. So I guess that is pretty good. But when I look at my notes for Which Way Western Man, it's like incomparable how much shit I picked up and wrote down. Basically with Haas, it's like every single paragraph I have to take note of something. So maybe it's just autism, but yeah.
No, it's the manner. I mean, Haas conveys very complex ideas. And right, this means that it's a dense work. You're going to have to be stopping and thinking. It requires like extra cogitation. Whereas other writings, like I'm willing to bet that I've not read this Benson thing, but I'm willing to bet that he tells the story of, the Zionist factor. He tells the story of the Jews' presence throughout the whole of history, let's say. And, as he does that, I bet you he does it in sort of a story narrative, like there's an arc and you're to understand how the Jews have impinged upon history throughout the 20th century, for example. That's very different than what Haas is doing. You know, Haas can't use that crutch, right? He's doing a pure nonfiction approach to some very esoteric subjects to help you better understand a completely foreign mindset.
Yeah.
Very different, very different challenge from someone doing what could be like a standard history book. You know what I mean?
Right. Hmm. Yeah. And just for comparison's sake, I did open up the notes, the actual docs that I had for my complete Which Way Western Man notes is 16 pages, 8,152 words. And just the chapter 8 of Haas's book is 7,554 words, 15 pages. So yeah. I almost took as many notes in one chapter of Haas as I did in 900 and some odd pages of Simpson.
Yeah, see the density difference.
Yeah.
Yes, because Simpson is, he's the main character of his own story for a large part of that book. Mm-hmm. And only later does he then get into, you know, ideas becoming the main character. So he relies very much on the crutch of writing with, you know, the character arc, and then later becomes the narrative arc.
Yeah, and I guess to be fair, chapter 19, part C, there's like 37 sections on Kikes that Simpson did, and I just truncated the entire thing because I said pretty much everything that he points out about media and banking. It's like a crash course.
Yes.
But it was all stuff that you and I already knew, and everybody in the chat, frankly, already knew. So, yeah, that probably took a huge portion of what I would have otherwise had to take the most notes on. So it's kind of an unfair comparison.
Oh, sure. Well, but then, yes, of course, you see why that part's in there. For the, imagine the unindoctrinated needing that, and that's why that's in there. But yes, I think it's fair to eliminate that, though. That's not the bulk of the book by any means. So
yeah, and you're right, dude. If it was like a Clockwork Orange, whatever that technique, what was it, Ludovico technique or whatever?
Yeah.
That would have been perfect. Like, just give him those 37 sections of Simpson's very in-depth research, and it would tell him everything they need to know.
That's right. Yep. Eyedroppers. Yep. And you cannot extricate yourself from the Ludovico technique or whatever it is until you've become supplicant, compliant, and fully indoctrinated.
Right.
There you go. All right. So what's next? Because you have on offering the possibility of, I'm not telling us what to do next, but the possibility of the immortality dialogue from Schopenhauer.
Yeah.
Studies in pessimism.
I was kind of excited about that because it would tie in with a lot of the other stuff that we've done so far. And I've actually mentioned it and a few of the concepts from it, but, yeah, I don't know how long it'll take, and I'm cool to just call it. I think we should save that for another time.
Yeah, something tells me this will always relate to Haas, and then we can just pull it in when there's maybe a particularly short chapter, which happens in Haas. So
yeah, and I thought this one would be short, but we did do a lot of like extemporaneous exploration, working it out, just talking off the cuff, so.
Yeah, clarification was needed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was kind of a tough one, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Although not as esoteric as others, it had a difficulty level that was some, you know, like diamond ski slope, so, you know.
Right. Yep, yep.
Nice, nice. All right, well, let's take an opportunity to, let's see, go over to the,
got a,
to the J. I think
you got a few donos on FTJ.
Oh, a few. Oh, okay. Yeah. Thanks for looking up. All right, here we go. Oh, I see. Load more. Yes, I have to load more. Okay. Ah, I see now what you're referring to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got a couple of happy birthday Uncle Addies and.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Uncle, everyone's favorite uncle in the comfy chair. There he is. All right. Well, let's go over to the dono drops and Smiles in Court with $1. Here you go, buddy.
Smiles in Court.
Smiles in Court.
Smiles in Court.
Smiles in Court.
Oh, I'm Smiles in Court. Smiles.
Ah, and Bushmaster says, Davis, I've seen them leave other women, mostly bodies on the side of the road until they're bones. If they're immediate family, they'll pick them up. If not, they let them rot on the roadside. So, yeah, Haas tracking again. Very, very interesting. He also says, I better stop that. Hold on. There we go. Bushmaster also saying, Eastern dignity. If you flood a continent with hoppy and drugs in order to control their markets and threaten them if they resist, you get a war on your hands. All right, so mentioning some black ops foreign policy there. And there was another comment I wanted to play. Oh, you messed up the joke. All right. That's what I was going to read, but I see now. Okay. Bigots in the house also. By the way, FTJ is now hopping. look at this Bushmaster. I feel better now. Here you go. Yeah. Boy, oh boy. The niggers become a meme again. What? Oh, no. Let me show you this one as well. The poor kid. Is that all one big noodle? Or is this, it's milk shooting out of the nostrils. Yogurt or something. I thought it was like a noodle going over the septum and then down the other nostril.
Yeah, from the thumbnail, I thought he put like chopsticks in his nose.
It could be chopsticks. You're right. Yeah. Oh, that's so crazy. Anyway, Bushmaster with 10 saying, "Heil to you, gentlemen." Oh, feckin' slash.
Thanks,
Bushmaster. Well, slash, back to you, buddy. So here we go.
Bushmaster.
6. A.
Bush.
Fish.
6.
A.
Bush.
Master.
The A says ah.
6.
A.
There you go. Yeah, the A does say ah. And this kid says,
fuck you. Pay me.
We heard you. So there we go. Breaking for chat. We're listening to this kid. Kid doesn't take any guff.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Mr. Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Fucking pay me.
Davis Lerman.
Fuck you, pay me.
Davis Lerman.
thanks, Sinead. All right. You've heard it. Now do it. Mm-hmm. Did I mention Banned by Amazon? Yes, I did. All right, I'll leave this up for a while.
Davis, we better check on Kick Chef, his ex, because I know he was tweeting when I was sick about, Luke Berg knows Taurus wouldn't join Davis's Masonic shit. That's why he left the show, spreading rumors.
Son of a bitch.
So we better see if he's, spreading the NPC rumor now, too.
This dirty motherfucker. yeah.
Odyssey chat died.
There you go. He also says, Kick Chef says, Asians confirmed flesh AIs. All right. Well, that's not, you're doing the bug people bit. I see what you're doing there. But they do seem that idea of the bug people, by the way, that this, we can truly attribute this to the differences in the Eastern versus the Western mind. Like, yes, they are in fact more bug-like, but they're more bug-like because because of the way their mind functions. They have a different system of distribution and use of knowledge, and they in fact prioritize entirely differently the things they consider and the emphasis they put certain considerations on things in a totally different way. So yes, bug people tracks. Mm-hmm. Tracks with Haas. Haas vindicated yet again. If he had only invented the term bug people.
Yeah, sorry, I was muted. I didn't realize that I was trying to agree with you. But
okay. Well, you can always do that.
We've brought it up before, like this you social or you sociality. Mm. And I guess it's just as applicable to Orientals as it would be to the Kike. It's like this very beneficial, organized hierarchy. where everything is cooperative. So when you say bug people, you know, to us, it seems like we think of bugs as diminutive, something that annoys you and you just flick it away, or it carries disease, you stomp it. You don't think anything of it when you smush it. But yeah, I mean, I guess it is just as easily applicable to say, what's eusocial? It's usually a lot of insects, not as many mammals.
Yes, in fact, yes. Colonies as opposed to packs or something, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like a collaborative effort that's natural. They don't have to really think about it. Because
they're almost in that autonomically in that state of agreement and, I mean, what would you call it? That industrious hum they're all engaged in.
Yeah. Yeah, like Haas pointed out earlier on, this distinction of, like, you can focus on the individual as one of the many. So personality and individuality, it still exists to the East, not as a concept, but more of like an inherent notion. And that personality or individuality is still connected with everything else. So it's kind of eusocial, just like bugs, you know, like they're individual bugs and they all have their own job and they all do whatever they're going to do. But they do it without even thinking, with the compassion of all of the other ants or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Or as Haas would say,
you could be mad about it if you want, but that's how this shit works, little nigga.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Haas. And this is where you do the two fingers up to your lips and then to the sky.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yes.
But anyway, so.
Right. Any closing thoughts, Luke? Anything you want to add for the folks by way of connective tissue to Chapter 10 of next week, or maybe recapitulation of something that impressed you about this chapter?
Nah, I feel like I said it all. So, as always, I'll just... you know, thank you and thank everybody else for hanging out.
Heck yeah. As always, it's been very productive. So come back for more. Now, by the way, I'm on 7 nights a week, 8 to 11. Sunday nights is something special, as you can tell. It's a whole different tenor, a whole different tone. We approach literature in review. And we try to do so in a way that helps the understanding, particularly of our guys and our girls. So more of that next Sunday. But in the meantime, Monday through Friday, you get the standard Right Perspective Radio news analysis and Friday's IRL Talk Live, which we're going to take a lot more StreamYard calls next Friday night. Saturday, we have something new for you coming up. We've already previewed a bit of that, at least conceptually. So come for White Perspective Radio's cinema review. This coming Saturday is a documentary we know you're going to be interested in, and it connects in deep ways to a lot of the white nationalist founders and, frankly, some of our contemporaries even. So we'll be doing that. It's always 8 to 11. That's my point. 8 to 11 every night. FTJ, Odyssey, Rumble, and in case you didn't know, in Entropy, you can see the show in the center panel as well as have an Entropy chat, which could be handy someday if Odyssey ever truly does go the way of the dinosaur, if it dies on the vine from not having any payment processor or not creating an internal system of coin that, you know, at least works better than the current one, the library coin. All right, guys. Luke has said he said it all. Yeah, I agree with that, in fact. So we may as well. Yeah, I mean, we did. We said a lot. There's no reason to trot over the tired ground. Let's just let it sit. And if need be, give the show a second listen, because the material is incredibly dense. And do afford yourself the opportunity to go back and listen from Chapter 1 on up. I think you'll find it very valuable. At the very least, it'll backfill your understanding, and I think bolster your understanding and appreciation for Destiny of the Mind, East and West.
Yeah.
Oy vey. Such a podcast.
Yup, yuppers and fabulous.
This is the biggest shift, right word?
Best show ever. Gosh.
The following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States.
Gosh.
It read, When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them as fascists or Nazis or anti-Semitic and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind. In the public mind, label them fact. Label them fascist. Fact. Label them Nazi. Fact. Label them anti-Semitic. Fact. After enough repetition, fact. Discredit them in the public mind. Fact.
Fact. Is it over already? Well, that sucks.
We can't do better than that. Nope.
Totally.
How do they do it?
Thanks so much.
We've just been on a run of really good shows lately.
Wow. Good job.
Yeah.
Extreme in every sense of the word.
It's premium content. Inciting hate and inciting hate.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. You said it all.
Is it always this good?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you're a white male. You have to be white for this to count, okay?
Hey, you can't use that word. It's racist. They can call themselves that, but we can't.
I hate you niggers so much.
Jews should not feel safe.
Full stop?
Jews should not feel safe.
The Jew problem.
Yeah. Sorry to go Jew mode on you guys. I apologize.
An explosion of Jew hatred.
Beep, 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 bye.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Notaris. Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Notaris.
Luke.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
Notaris.
Luke.
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 Notaris.
Luke.
Luke.
Right Perspective Radio.
And it was so, so powerful.
Thanks for watching. Bye.
Davis Lerman.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye.
One purpose, one people, we are rising. One purpose, one people, we are rising.